Okay. All right. Let's get started. Everybody have a handout and a paper class card? Anybody else? There you go. Okay, so before we get into talking about cardiovascular psychophysiology, I just have a couple of announcements to start. Everyone passed the electricity test, so congratulations. That's the first time this has happened. So I'm not sure I want a couple of you working on my house, but most of you are probably certified to do just about anything. So. Also, I had some technical difficulties last time with the audio podcast, which is I forgot to hit the button to start it. So Roisin has all this complicated paraphernalia, and she gets the video podcast right, and I didn't get this started. My plan is to make an audio podcast out of that video, so if you don't want to download the video and you want the audio, it'll be up eventually, but it's just delayed. So if you're looking for that and it's not there, that's why. Okay. For those of you in lab, we'll meet this Thursday. We'll be talking about the cardiovascular system then. And let's start with some 3x5s from last time. So, a frequently asked question with some variant of, what do I do for my paper? Okay. How do I get started with this? It's overwhelming. What kind of topics should I look for? So I'm assuming, you know, those of you in the graduate section probably have some topics that are of interest, and this wouldn't be quite such an issue, so I'm going to confine these remarks mostly to people who might be seeking more broadly. One answer to this question is come to my office hour, I'm happy to talk about it, but in advance of that it would be helpful if you thought about an area of psychology that interested you. If you took social psychology, you thought it was fascinating. You took abnormal psychology, you thought it was fascinating. Think about a general content area that interests you, and then do a lit search looking for, say, that topic in social psych, let's say cognitive dissonance, and psychophysiology, and just see what comes up. Another option would be go find the journal Psychophysiology and just start browsing the table of contents and see what kinds of articles are there. There are all kinds of measures and all kinds of topics. Something might start to appeal to you, and then you could come in and start talking to me during office hours. My office hours are Wednesdays at 4 and Fridays at 1. Okay. All right. Also on the paper theme, may we turn in a rough draft of our paper early to see if we're on the right track? Sure, I'd be happy to take a look at it. I can't read it in its entirety. Usually, if there's a lot of this, I'd be reading everybody's paper twice. But I'm happy to take a look at it, happy to discuss it in office hour. You'll also be turning in a paragraph or so prospectus of the paper ahead of time where you'll also get some feedback about whether or not you're on the right track. But feel free to make good use of my office hours surrounding the paper and anything else. Okay. A vexing question. Just curious, which came first, the lie detector or Wonder Woman? Wonder Woman used the lasso of truth that forced people to speak honestly. Was this a result of Marston's lie detector work, or was he, let's just say, preoccupied with people lying to him? So we have a Wonder Woman aficionado here. Well, I looked it up. 26 years elapsed between the invention of the polygraph and the first edition of Wonder Woman. So he certainly could be preoccupied with people lying to him, but it might have resulted from some of his work. All right. All right. The guilty knowledge test protects against false positives. So we talked about how the standard polygraph test, although reasonably good at identifying guilty people, far too often had false positive outcomes where innocent people looked guilty. And the guilty knowledge test, which relied on memory instead of on fear, was better at protecting against that. But it also might have some problems in that sometimes you could find false negatives if people didn't recognize a key aspect of the crime situation. So is there a way to protect against it? Well, the simple answer is have a better test. But that's easier said than done, and people have been working on this for a long period of time. And the problem is one of some kind of continuous score that separates people in two categories. So it's one of these, there's two types of people in the world situations, where I always like to say there are two types of people in the world, those who think there are two types of people, and those who don't. But there's two types of people. There's liars and there's truth tellers, right? And there's some continuous measure, skin conductance, amplitude, the number of responses, anything you like that's going to try to separate them. But unless you have a perfect test, they won't be perfectly separated. So there's going to be this problem here. You want to separate the groups as far as possible, and you won't have false negatives, and you won't have false positives. But usually what we're left with is some kind of a shift in a cutting score to distinguish one from the other. So we don't know really what distribution the person belongs to when we're conducting a lie detector test, right? We don't know if they're lying or they're not, or we wouldn't be conducting the test. all we have is this measure along the x-axis here. So let's say, for example, that these are the innocent people. There's a few more innocent people than guilty people, but they overlap. There's some people in both groups who have scores in this range. So we could start out saying, let's protect the innocent. We'll put a cut point here, and there'll be very few innocent people who score above that cut point, and we'll get a bunch of guilty people. But then here are a whole bunch of false negatives. So if we want to reduce the false negative rate, we shift the cut point over, and now we pick up a lot more of the guilty people. Look what's happened. Now we're getting a lot of these innocent people as scoring above the cut point as well. So one other thing that you might do is not use this as a definitive test, but the first test in a series of tests, right? So if I were to say anybody who scores below this cut point is exempt from further consideration, they're clearly not going to be guilty by this test. I'll miss a few people. Okay? But now I have a whole bunch of people, some of whom are guilty, innocent, some who are guilty, and maybe I could do some other tests then on them to follow up and try to figure out if they're guilty or innocent. But in the end, this problem of false negatives and false positives is going to be an issue of how far apart these distributions are from one another and how much they overlap. Now, one thing I did suggest once, and I got into a little bit of trouble with some reviewers for this, was what about a case where somebody had taken a standard field polygraph, where we know it's quite vulnerable to false positive outcomes, and then they also had taken a guilty knowledge test using event-related brain potentials, which I didn't talk about in detail last time. I talked a little bit about it at the very beginning lecture. And that test suffers from more problems with false negatives. Okay? So you've got one test that has too many false positives, one that has too many false negatives. Somebody who is negative on both would almost surely be innocent. Somebody who is positive on both would almost surely be guilty. And people where the verdicts didn't agree would have to be regarded as indeterminate, or you couldn't, you know, certainly say anything with certainty. Statistically speaking, that's the defensible statement. In terms of policy, the reviewers jumped all over me for suggesting anybody would take a polygraph. And I was trying to be clear. I'm not suggesting anybody take a polygraph. But if they had already taken one, then might we make use of that in trying to up our overall hit rate. Okay. Interesting question. Given the fact that people do have skin conductance responses to things they didn't process consciously, what's the level of awareness that's required for the guilty knowledge test? Should the person remember the details or just have been exposed to it in order to have an orienting response to it? So this would open up the possibility that criminals might not need to be so attentive to all the details of the crime, and you could still detect it. And there, we talked about the prosopagnosia study where we saw skin conductance orienting responses clearly in the absence of awareness. This is but one example. I think there you might be able on the group level, if you have a large number of subjects, to find some differentiation between items that people were exposed to but don't consciously remember and items they were never exposed to. But at the level of individual subjects, it probably wouldn't be sufficiently robust to differentiate people guilty from innocent. So back to the distributions as a way of thinking about this, if this is our standard guilty knowledge test, we have a pretty decent separation of the distributions, so we can draw a cut point and do a reasonable job of classifying innocent and guilty people correctly. But if you are looking then at skin conductance responses to things that might not be consciously remembered, if there's any effect at all, it's likely to be smaller. There'll be likely more overlap in the distribution, and I think you're going to have more troubles with false positives and false negatives, depending where you put your cut point. So, although I think it would be useful for some kinds of investigations in an applied setting where each person has to be classified, this wouldn't have a sufficiently large effect size to be accurate, would be my guess. Okay, and this was a twice-asked question, so it's not quite frequently asked, but it was asked more than once. And this is the popular book by Paul Ekman discusses training people to recognize lying by recognizing subtle facial clues. How accurate is this? So we talked about this briefly, where people have these micro expressions, and they're facial expressions that are very brief and fleeting and don't otherwise fit within the context of what the person is expressing. And people can recognize those, and they seem to be correlated with deception. So I looked at this, and Paul Ekman has been doing work on this topic, and even deception specifically, for close to 40 years now. And there's a strong scientific basis for this, and the general claim that he makes, and this is from a summary article, in 2006 article in Behavioral Sciences and the Law, is that voluntary and involuntary expressions differ from one another in their appearance, their timing, their symmetry, and their cohesion across muscle groups of facial expressions of emotion. So when people are lying, they may be trying to put on one face when they may have another face, and these are going to be detectable. So there's a strong scientific basis for it. What I could not find anywhere was any clear hit rate data in applied settings. So we don't know how well this works in terms of classifying individual subjects at this point, at least not from my look at the peer-reviewed literature. Whether or not that'll be forthcoming, I don't know. But I think it's a promising approach, but we'd need to know how well it separates those distributions so we can know what the hit rates are for individual subjects. Okay. And then the final one, are we going to hit ERPs in more detail? I really don't understand them and would love another explanation. Oh yes, we will. Sit back, buckle up, and we'll spend about 4 lectures on this thing. So, okay. All right. So today we're going to talk about the heart and the other aspects of the cardiovascular system. This is one of the most complicated systems. I mean, people think about autonomic psychophysiology as somehow simple. It's very simple to obtain. You put a couple of electrodes on, you get a nice clean signal. It is easy. Interpretation can be much more difficult. And so I'm going to try to cover some of the basics of the cardiovascular system, some of the different measures that we might use, and talk about some applications of cardiovascular psychophysiology in the course of the lecture today. So starting out, maybe a few facts and functions about the heart. The heart is a very busy organ. It never stops, at least it shouldn't anyway. It's not good for your health. It pumps about 6 quarts of blood every minute of every day that you're alive. That translates to about 100,000 beats per day. The heart is about the size of your fist. And so as a demonstration, I want you to try this. Imagine that right now your heart's kind of taking a little vacation and your fist is responsible for pumping that blood. Okay, start pumping. Okay. And now you can't be wimpy about this or you're going to pass out, right? You've got to pump a good amount of blood. You're going to get 6 quarts a minute. Just start pumping that thing. And what you'll appreciate fairly soon, I believe, the heart does a lot of work, right? You can start to feel your muscles getting tense. Now, it's not a totally fair comparison. We're using striate muscle here, and the heart is a special muscle, cardiac muscle. But the heart is a very busy organ. It doesn't take a break, I think you can appreciate how much work it does. Okay. Now, it has many functions, but primary among them are transporting oxygen and nutrients to all the target organs in the body. It also transports waste products back from those target organs to organs that can take care of them. It can translate regulatory substances. These are endogenously produced like endocrines and can also be exogenously taken like pharmacological products. And it also provides a way of regulating our core temperature. Since we're warm-blooded and we have to maintain a constant internal temperature, this allows us to exchange or minimize the exchange of heat between the core and the periphery. And that'll happen through the dilation or the constriction of the peripheral vasculature. Now, if we think about the heart from the perspective of psychophysiology, we're interested in changes in heart that are due to psychologically interesting phenomena. But this has to be considered in the context of what the heart really does and what it reacts to most, and that is changes in activity level. So these are the demands for blood in milliliters at rest for various organs. You see the brain takes 750 milliliters, all of the peripheral muscles 1.2 liters, kidney 1.1 liters, and so on. And as you move from rest to light exercise to strenuous exercise to maximal exercise, you can see, of course, total metabolic demand goes up. We need much more blood to be circulating. But most of that is consumed by the muscle. And of interest, the brain is invariant. It needs about the same amount of blood at all times. Now, there are subtle changes in blood flow, and that's the basis for MRI. But overall, the amount of blood going to the brain is relatively unchanged. The heart, as you start exercising, takes some more blood. The muscle makes the biggest change. And of course, some organs, which aren't going to be as active during strenuous exercise as rest, like the abdomen, actually decrease their use. They go from 1,400 to 1,100 to 600 to 250 milliliters.
Is that in milliliters?
It's milliliters per minute, I believe. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How much is a quart in
milliliters? A quart is just, 3.8 quarts. No. A liter and a quart are close to the same. So a quart is 32 ounces and a liter is 33.8 ounces. So a liter is a little more than a quart. Okay. So 6 quarts, let's make that about 5.5 liters. Okay. All right. Okay. So we're going to be interested, of course, in changes in cardiac function. But if, you know, between people or between experimental conditions, there are also changes in activity level, those could easily dwarf any of the changes you're likely to see related to your psychological manipulation. Okay, so let's start by talking about the basic anatomy of the heart. Some of this is probably things that most people know. Some of it might be new. So the heart is made of a special kind of muscle, appropriately termed cardiac muscle. And it's also known as the myocardium. It's not striated muscle, which is the type that you see in the periphery, the kind of muscle that would be used in, you know, biceps, triceps, quadriceps, and all of those great muscles. And it's not smooth muscle like we see in the gut. The stomach is a kind of muscle known as smooth muscle. And there are four features that distinguish this cardiac muscle from either striate or smooth muscle. And these are important features that help it to beat regularly and also not spiral out of control in any particular way. So the first of these is that the cardiac muscle has an unstable resting potential. So it's the basis for an intrinsic depolarization. You don't need to do anything other than provide nutrients for the heart to keep beating. There doesn't need to be an external source to make the heart beat. Now when the heart stops beating, sometimes people apply an external source, right, with a defibrillator or one of those code blue carts. But you don't need that if the heart's working normally, right? You feed it and it runs. And that's because it has an inherently unstable resting potential. It's also the case that the action potential is freely conducted from one one cell to another. So you don't need to have them necessarily follow through various nerves. There are pathways in there, for example, going from the SA node to the AV node, but within the heart cardiac muscle itself, the action potential can go from one cell to another, allowing the whole heart to contract in a coordinated fashion. Third, the repolarization is longer than a typical muscle, and it's about 100 milliseconds. And finally, the contraction phase is also longer. So with fast twitch muscles in the periphery, they can act real quickly and then they'll be done, but with the cardiac muscle, the duration of the cardiac action potentials is longer. So there's an initial depolarization and then a sustained period of depolarization that's about 0.2 to 0.3 seconds. So that allows there to be a long contraction, which is enough to expel the blood out of the heart. If you had just a quick contraction, it might not get enough blood out of there, so it needs to be sustained. Now in terms of the four chambers of the heart, in this anatomically correct diagram, you see we have the right and left atria and the right and left ventricle. You're looking at this person as if they're looking back at you. So you see it's like that. So right appears to be on the left and left appears to be on the right. The basic flow of blood, as you probably remember from a previous biology class, is that blood from the periphery enters the right atrium, then goes to the right ventricle where it's pumped to the lungs to be oxygenated, returns into the left atrium, and then goes into the left ventricle where it's pumped to the body. Okay. So we'll go over that in slightly more anatomically correct detail here in just a second. But if you think coming from the periphery into the, it always comes into the atria and out the ventricles, the right side deals with venous blood that's been deoxygenated, and the left side deals with oxygenated blood that's either returning from the lungs or being pumped to the body. Okay. So here we have again the heart shown with its various cavities and valves and vessels. So if we start here at the superior vena cava, this is going to be a draining vessel coming from the head. There's also an inferior vena cava here, and that's coming from the body. Both of those then drain into the right atrium here. So you have it coming inferior vena cava from the body, superior vena cava from the brain and the head, and all of that deoxygenated blood, these veins, are draining into the right atrium. From there it passes, first passively and later actively through some contraction, into the right ventricle here, so the ventricle being below the atria. When the right ventricle expels it, it goes through the pulmonary artery. The pulmonary trunk is listed here. It's the only artery that carries deoxygenated blood. Right, so it's going away from the heart but to the lung. And then it's oxygenated by the lung, and it returns in the pulmonary vein. It's the only vein that carries oxygenated blood. And then it goes into the left atrium. And from there, it passively at first and then actively is pushed into the left ventricle before it's then expelled out through the aorta here out to the body. And so that's the general pathway, and it's moving in a nonstop fashion. And what we'll do over the course of the next few slides is break down the timing of these different events and how the pressures change inside the various components here that we've just discussed. Now here's a little bit more of a schematic of it if you like to see this instead. Same thing we've talked about here. If we begin here with the vena cava and the systemic veins, they're collecting deoxygenated blood, goes into the heart, pumps it through the pulmonary arteries through the lungs, comes back through the pulmonary veins into the heart, and then it's distributed out through the brain and the body. Okay. So this picture comes from the chapter in the text, and this just shows again in a little bit more detail. Again, here we have the superior vena cava coming from the head, the inferior vena cava from the body, dumping here into the right atrium, then it will go into the right ventricle, pumped out to the lung, and then as it gets oxygenated here, it gets a lighter gray in this grayscale diagram, and at that point it's pumped back to the left atrium, into the left ventricle, and finally then out through up to the head and down through the body as well. Okay. Now, in addition to the vessels and the chambers being the atrium and the ventricles, the vessels being things like the aorta, the pulmonary vein, the vena cava, there are also a series of valves that are important because without them the system wouldn't work particularly well. And there is the right atrial ventricular valve and the left atrial ventricular valve. And these valves also have other names you might have heard. The right is the tricuspid and the left is the mitral valve. And sometimes people have valve prolapse where the valves don't seal properly, and that can cause some difficulty with circulation, ranging from kind of benign to something that needs to be repaired surgically. So the purpose of these valves here, the tricuspid and the mitral valve, or the right and left AV valve, is to prevent blood from flowing backwards. So the way I've talked about the system so far, it's a one-way system. If it works properly, it is a one-way system. But if blood is draining from the atrium into the ventricle, there's an opening there, and then when the ventricle squeezes, if there was nothing here to keep it out of the atrium, then in addition to blood going out to the body, it would come shooting back up into the atrium. It would be a pretty inefficient system. So these valves, if you're looking down, when they open, they hang loosely, and then when pressure builds up in the ventricle, they snap shut. They snap shut like that. And that happens both on the left and on the right. And so this rapid buildup of pressure in the ventricles forces them to snap shut, and this produces one of the heart sounds. So you can think of the heart sounds as lub-dub, 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 and this is the lub of the lub-dub sound. Okay? Both of those sounds are valve closures, and this is the first of the two sounds. And the simultaneous or near simultaneous snapping shut of these two valves. And that happens as the ventricles begin to contract. So the symptoms, obviously, of having some valve trouble would be there's improper circulation, and people could feel winded. They could feel like they're not getting enough oxygen, feel dizzy, and so on. Okay, and if nobody's ever heard the great lub-dub sound, lub-dub, 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 okay? All right. So it's the first of the sounds. Sounds like a soundtrack to a horror movie. Okay. All right. Now there are other valves as well that are important, and these are the aortic and the pulmonary valves. And they also have the same function of keeping the blood flowing in one direction. If these valves didn't function, blood could also then come back into the heart once it had been expelled. So the left ventricle, when it contracts, pushes blood out into the aorta. And once the ventricle is done contracting, pressure is going to reduce in the ventricle. And without this valve, it could come back from the aorta right back into the left ventricle. Similarly, on the right side, when the right ventricle contracts, it's out into the pulmonary artery. And then without this valve, when the pressure is reduced inside the ventricle after it's contracted, then the blood could come back down in. So it'd be a pretty inefficient system. So these also respond to pressure differences between the ventricles and either the aorta or the pulmonary artery. And these are normally closed until the ventricle starts to build up pressure, and then they shoot open. And then when the pressure reduces, they slam shut. And so this is going to be the dub of the lub dub sound. So all the sounds that you should hear are valves closing. You don't hear valves opening, right? Because there's nothing that they you know, forcefully hit. They just kind of open. But when they snap shut, you're hearing the dub or the lub, depending which ones they are. Okay. I have it here again if anybody wants it, but I think you've got the idea. Okay. All right. Now there are other sounds. It's interesting, if you go out and you search for heart sounds, you can get all kinds of interesting wave files of abnormal heart sounds. Some of them sound kind of syncopated, some have kind of a reggae beat, but none of these are things that you'd actually want. They indicate some problem with the timing. But sometimes, for example, if both of the AV valves aren't synchronized in their timing, so in other words, the left and right atria are not particularly synchronized in their contractions, the S1 can have a little bit of a double. So the lub dub. Right? Or if the other valves, at the aorta and the pulmonary aren't synchronized, you can get a double on the second sound. So lub dub dub, and so on. So there's a lot of information that people can glean just by listening to the heart, usually indicating, you know, fairly obvious pathology. Now, in terms of neural conduction, there are two nodes that provide pacing for the heart. There's the sinoatrial node, and this is the big boss. This is the primary pacemaker, and this is going to initiate all cardiac contractions. And then there's a yoked atrial ventricular valve, and it's yoked to the SA node. Okay. Now, both of them have an intrinsic rhythmicity that they can spontaneously fire, but they're very different rates, so that the SA node spontaneously fires at about 105 beats per minute. But the AV node, which is subservient to it, if there were no input from the SA node, it would still fire, but only at about 40 to 60 beats per minute. So the SA node signal keeps this going faster than it would on its own. So the SA node provides a pacing for the AV node by virtue of the SA node having its inherent pacemaking. So one of the things then that's an implication of this is if you didn't have any external influence to the heart, you snipped the sympathetic and parasympathetic inputs to the SA node, then the denervated heart would still beat along at over 100 beats per minute, probably somewhere around the SA node intrinsic frequency, about 105 beats per minute in humans. Okay? So most of the time, I hope, when people are sitting, they don't have a heartbeat of 105 beats per minute. So there has to be an extrinsic or external slowing of the heart. And that happens. So in other words, the heart is a system that the cardiac system has the heart set to go faster than it needs to if in the absence of input. So most of the time there's a break, if you like the metaphor of a break, on the heart. And as we'll see, that's provided primarily by the parasympathetic nervous system inputs. Okay. And so this hierarchy with these two different spontaneous firing rates ensures that the SA node is going to be the boss and drive the system. And these AV nodes provide a critical delay that allow the atria to fully contract before the ventricles do. So the SA node will initiate atrial contraction, but the AV node initiates ventricular contraction. So by having the two nodes, atria contract first, the signal then reaches the AV node, and then the ventricles contract. Also important is this AV node has a refractory period that's long enough to prevent the heart from going into tetanus. Right? You wouldn't want it to be such that it just keeps firing, or it couldn't fill and you wouldn't have any blood and things would be over pretty quickly. And so it's a coordinated wave of depolarization, and the contraction of the four chambers of the heart center are precisely choreographed through this system of these two nodes that then drive the system. So I think it's the next one we'll see. So here's a picture of these different things. Not a great picture, but one that gives you the idea. So here we have the SA node situated up here near the atria. And so that's the master pacemaker. And it has fibers that are both internodal, going from the SA node down here to the AV node. So there's internodal fiber. And also interatrial fibers that go between the two atria. So when this depolarizes, it's going to send a signal to the AV node while also causing the atria to contract. So when it goes off, atria contract right away, and there's a bit of a lag in the timing as it goes down here to the AV node. This signal on these internodal fibers is a bit slow. It's about a half a meter to a meter per second, and that gives us approximately a 100 to 200 millisecond delay between the onset of depolarization here and the onset of depolarization here, meaning there will also be a similar delay between atrial contraction and ventricular contraction. So in case it's not clear, you know, the reason you'd want the atria to contract first is, although there's passive draining of blood through the system, there's still going to be blood collecting in the atria. They contract and push any remaining blood, or at least a lot of the remaining blood, out of the atria and into the ventricle, so there's the maximum amount of blood possible in the ventricle before the ventricle is going to contract and push it out either to the lungs or to the body. So then here we have the AV node, which then fires. It sends its signal down along this bundle of hips, and also at the end of these Purkinje fibers, and there's a massive coordinated contraction of the heart, or of the ventricles more specifically. Okay, so in action then, this is just another way to look at it. You see the SA node fires, and it has many inputs to the two atria, causing them to contract. A time-delayed signal going to the AV node, at which point then it goes down the bundle of hips into all the Purkinje fibers, causing the two ventricles to contract in a coordinated fashion. Okay. And also, this refractory period on the AV node is longer than the time it physically takes these ventricles to contract. So they'll contract fully, and then they'll start to relax before this thing can fire again. So it prevents tetanus, prevents from the ventricles being constantly contracted. Okay, so these are depolarizations, and they're going to generate electrical signals. And so that's what we measure when we look at the EKG waveform. So the electrocardiogram, K, because it was first published in German, people will also use ECG. They're interchangeable. I don't know if one is preferred over the other. I'm seeing ECG more and more, but you can see either one. And it's an electrical signal, and there are going to be, the morphology of this waveform will change depending on where you place the electrodes, and we'll talk about that in a little more detail later. But the timing of these different events should be constant no matter where you place your electrodes on a given individual. And these are labeled P, Q, R, S, and T, and I'm not sure why they skipped the first section of the alphabet, but it's P, Q, R, S, and T. And they correspond to particular events. P corresponds to atrial depolarization. Okay, it's the passage of electrical activity through the SA node and commencing atrial depolarization. Now, when people use, for example, 12 lead AKGs, where they're positioned in known places across the chest, then the amplitude of these waves can be quite important. But if you're recording this in the psychophysiology lab, you're likely to be recording from a couple of peripheral sites like the arm or the arm and the leg. You can't make definitive conclusions based on the amplitudes of these waves. But if you had a 12-lead AKG, you might see an enlargement of the P wave if people had atrial hypertrophy, so the atria are enlarged, for example. So after atrial depolarization commences, there's, of course, that lag while the internodal fibers allow the transmission of the signal from the SA node to the AV node. And then the QRS complex here, not a Freudian complex, but a QRS complex, is ventricular depolarization. This is the passage of electrical activity through the AV node and into the ventricles. And so the normal QRS duration is going to give you some idea of the time it takes to initiate depolarization of the ventricles. After they've depolarized or fully contracted, then they must repolarize, and you can see here at T, this is ventricular repolarization. And as you note here, atrial repolarization is just not visible. It's occurring somewhere in this window, and it's just masked by the large QRS complex. So this is highly schematized, but that's kind of what it looks like. A couple of slower bumps here for the atrial depolarization and the ventricular repolarization, and a very fast feature here in the middle for the ventricular depolarization. And I'm always struck by the schematized waveform. It just looks a lot like this other kind of schematized figure here. Now, people can get into measuring all kinds of intervals, and these intervals can be diagnostically important. And these intervals, you know, you could work them out yourself. They're between the different features, PQ, PR, PS, and so on. But a couple of them I'll just mention here because they might be important. This PR interval here, time from the onset of the P wave to, or PQ here, PQ interval, for example, or PR interval, tells you the time it takes for the signal to go from the SA node to the AV node, or from the atria to the ventricles. So that could index conduction problems if it's prolonged. If it takes too long for the signal to go from the SA node to the AV node, that would indicate some problem in conduction between the two nodes. The QT interval, it's the duration of the ventricular contraction phase, and you've probably heard the word systolic in terms of blood pressure. Well, the contraction phase is known as systole, S-Y-S-T-O-L-E. So it's the duration of ventricular systole is from Q to T. So it's the onset of contraction to the beginning or till the repolarization phase. And so this QT interval starts with Q and then terminates when T has finished. And that's, of course, going to vary as a function of heart rate. Right? When your heart is beating faster, it's going to be a shorter interval. But it could also indicate some problems as well if it's prolonged. And the ST interval is timing between the end of depolarization and end of repolarization. And an abnormal interval could indicate some damage like ischemia, for example. Now, the electrical signal then is reasonably simple. A lot of the kinds of things that we would be doing in the psychophysiology lab simply involve getting the timing of one beat to the next to the next. We're really interested in rate or changes in rate. And so for that, we'd just be identifying the R spike and where it occurs, and then the next R spike, and the next R spike, and the next R spike, and so on. And I'll show you some examples of that in a little bit. But when this happens, it's a really active system. So this is a nice demonstration here. This didn't come out on the printout, and I apologize, but it is available in theory at this site. Well, I went to this site, and it finds it, but it doesn't show me a flash animation. So I have these files, and I'll try to make them available to you. But let's just take a look at this. We'll slow it down because it's going far too fast to do anything with. Okay. So here we are at the beginning, and the beginning here is prior to atrial depolarization. So a cardiac cycle has completed. Blood is now returning from the body. As we step forward, what you're going to see, could you turn the lights off for just a second? I don't know how that's going to work for the video, but there's going to be some darker colors coming into this schematic of the heart here. And so as we step forward, okay, so now you see some blood passively flowing in from the superior and inferior vena cava and into the right atrium there. And as we move ahead here, the blood still flows on into the atrium. You can also see it here into the left atrium as well. And then it's still filling, and it's now passively flowing also just straight through the open AV valves here into the two ventricles. So far, there's been no electrical signal at all. This is all a passive flow from pressure in the system. And now at this point, we're almost to the point of atrial depolarization. So the blood's still flowing through, and now we begin to see atrial depolarization, and that's indicated here The SA node is beginning to fire, and you can see there are these interatrial fibers and also fibers going down to the AV node as well. As we step ahead, there's atrial contraction, and it's going to expel the blood at a faster rate into the ventricles. And now we see also that some of the signal is reaching down towards the AV node. And the ventricles are spewing the blood in, or the atria is spewing the blood into the ventricles. Now at this point, we're about to come up to the QRS complex. And as we do so, you can see the AV node has now fired and the signal is traveling down along the bundle of His. And as it does so, we start to see ventricular contraction. So I don't know if you can see this. The valves are open here, these valves, the AV valves. And once contraction begins, those valves flap shut. That's the lub. Okay. Feel the lub. And then it goes on out the aorta, okay, or the pulmonary artery, depending which side we're looking at. And there's, you know, continued contraction, and then now these fibers have repolarized, and you notice though that the ventricles are still contracted, so there's still pressure pushing through. So these valves, the aortic valve and the pulmonary valve there are still open, but pretty soon there'll be more pressure in the aorta and in the pulmonary artery than it is in those two atria, and those valves then flap shut. So if we go back one step, they're open, there's still pressure, now there's not enough pressure and they slap shut, preventing the blood from flowing backwards into the ventricles. Okay. And then the whole thing just starts over again. Because they diagram it as if there's no blood continuing to flow in here, but of course there would be. This, you know, is always filling up. Even while the ventricles are contracting, there's a passive filling of the atria. Okay. So let me see if people have questions about that. I'm hoping that makes it really clear, but I don't want to assume that, so let me know. Okay, maybe we could have the lights again. Okay. All right, so now this diagram is one from the previous version of the text. There's also one very much like it in the current version of the text. I like this one a little better because I already had it marked up. So I'm using this one, but the same idea is present in both of them. So walking through these different measurements of different components of the heart, hopefully will help you again understand what's going on. So let's start then up top with the EKG signal. It's a lead 2 electrocardiogram, simply means they have it on one arm and one leg. And we see this is the classic PQRST complex. And you can see it's very elongated here, just so that we can see all the changes that are going on within one cardiac cycle. So keep in mind, if the heart were beating, say, 60 beats a minute, we're looking at about 1 second of time across here. Okay. In terms of what's contracting, you know, most of the time there's not contraction. And here, during the passive filling phase, nothing's contracting. Once the P wave comes, that initiates atrial contraction. We see that here. And then the QRS complex initiates ventricular contraction, and that happens here over a slightly more sustained period of time. Now what that does then is cause changes in pressure. And so let's begin here. This solid line here is going to be, well, let's start with the dashed line. This is atrial pressure, and they're diagramming just left here for simplicity. It would be similar for the right. So there is a slow and steady increase in pressure as the atrium passively fill. So there's just, you know, water, blood pouring into the atria. It's like, you know, water filling a balloon, for example. So there's an increase in pressure. And then once there is the contraction of the atria, you can see there's a bit more increase in atrial pressure until the conclusion of contraction, at which point it drops again for a while. Now, the ventricular pressure then, while the valve is open, it's the same as the atria. Right? So the ventricle being beneath the atrium, the blood flowing passively in is going to have the same pressure as the atrium. And as the atria increases its pressure to push the blood into the ventricle, it increases. But then at this point with ventricular contraction, All of a sudden, the ventricle has much more pressure, the valve flaps shut, and the two pressures diverge. And there's a rapid increase here in ventricular pressure. So this is the closing, the lub, of the mitral valve between the atrium and the ventricle. But there's a period of time where that aortic valve is also closed. So both valves are closed, and the ventricle is contracting with two closed valves. So there's no change in the volume of liquid, but there's an increase in the pressure. So it's a period of isovolumetric contraction. So same volume of liquid, but increase in pressure. It's a rapid increase in pressure until the pressure in the ventricle exceeds that in the aorta. The aortic valve opens, doesn't make any sound that we can detect. And then it eventually after the ventricle has contracted, that aortic valve snaps shut, and then there's a drop in ventricular pressure. Now, if we look at the aortic pressure, it's the highest during ventricular contraction, and so then it slowly decreases over time as the blood flows throughout the system. And right here, when the valve is pushed open by the increased pressure in the ventricle, blood comes rushing into the aorta, and there's an increase in aortic pressure, and that follows pretty much precisely the pressure in the ventricle until the valve then closes shut again. Ventricular pressure drops, but aortic pressure has a little bit of an increase in pressure due to that valve closing, and then it continues its slow decrease over time as the blood then flows throughout the body. We look at the heart sounds, we just talked about those. The lub-dub are corresponding to the closing of the AV valves, in this case the mitral valve for the left atrioventricle junction, and corresponds to the closing of the aortic valve here, so lub-dub. And then finally we can talk about the amount of fluid, amount of blood, in the ventricle. And so the ventricle is never fully empty. There's always some blood left in the ventricle, but you want to have a large amount of the potential blood ejected. It's called the ejection fraction, and if that's too low, you're not expelling enough blood. So in this case, it's about 60 milliliters of blood here during diastole, during the period where there's no contraction. And as it passively fills, you see it increases, up to somewhere a little over 120 milliliters. And then there's a little extra push right here simultaneous with atrial contraction. So there's this passive filling and then this little bump here at the end as the atria expel their contents into the ventricles. Remember, during isovolumetric contraction, there's no change in the volume of blood. There's just an increase in pressure. And then once the valve comes open, out goes the blood, and there's a big decrease in the volume of blood in the ventricle. And so the change from the maximum amount to the minimum amount in the ventricle is the stroke volume. And so you can see it went from a little over 120 down to 60. So a usual ejection fraction would be something like 55 to 75% of the volume expelled. And if it's smaller than that, there could be cardiac pathology. And then finally, this is a measure of flow into and out of the aorta. So outflow is coming, you know, going away from the heart, from the aorta towards all of the body and the brain. And so the outflow, you know, it flows fairly constantly. There's a little bit of decrease as the overall pressure decreases. The outflow from the aorta increases as the pressure increases in the aorta, and then it goes down again. What really changes in the aorta is the inflow, that coming from the heart into the aorta. So there's nothing coming, whammo, it comes in, and then nothing comes in again. So the aorta itself has some stretchy properties to it, so that when the blood is pumped into it, it can expand, and then it slowly can, you know, keep the pressure high, and then it can flow out to the body. Okay. So this is very similar to figure 8.2 in your text. They've got things in a little different order, and they have a couple of cardiac cycles, but I think you can see it's much the same. Okay. So this happens, you know, 60, 80, 100 times a second. If you're exercising, 140 times a second. Or 140 times a minute. It's a very fast system. 140 times a second, we're not doing so well. Okay. Yeah. All right. Yes?
Which of the pressures is what is measured when your blood pressure is taken?
Okay, so it depends where you take the blood pressure, but what we'll be measuring there is going to be roughly correspondent to the some arterial pressure, so it's going to be correlated with aortic pressure. And the, it's always two numbers, systolic over diastolic. The systolic will be this peak pressure here, and the diastolic will be the minimum pressure prior to contraction again. Usually it's going to be measured in the artery on the arm, and you want it at the same level as the heart so you don't have any pressure due to gravity, but it's only due to flow. Okay, and so then this also on this diagram you can see here says systole, and systole is from the onset of ventricular contraction until the conclusion of ventricular contraction. That's systole. And the rest of the cycle is diastole. Systole takes about 1/3 of the cardiac cycle, and diastole about 2/3 of the cardiac cycle. So it's working really hard for 1/3 of the time and just relaxing for the other 2/3 of the time. At least the ventricles are doing so. Okay. Now we have a diagram that shows some of these features as well. This is also a flash animation. I don't know if this one is still available. After I couldn't find the last one, I just made sure that I have all the files, and I do. So I'll make these available to you on a kind of private link, since they are somebody else's intellectual property. I want to give them credit, but would like you to be able to see them. So here, here's the standard PQRST waveform. That one's probably not something we want to spend a lot of time with. Here's the heart sound. S4 and S3 you shouldn't hear in a healthy heart. Just S1 and S2 would be the ones that you typically hear. And then here are the different pressures in the aorta, the ventricle, and the atria, and then also an indication of ventricular volume. So as we step ahead here, let's turn the light off again and see how that will work. Thank you. So in this diagram, you can see there's blood that's flowing from the atria into the ventricles, indicated by arrows and little blobs, I guess, would be lack of a better term. And as we move ahead here, during this phase, which is atrial systole, the atria now, atrial systole would be the period of contraction of the atria. They're contracting, and that's what these arrows are indicating. They're shooting blood into the ventricle. And during that time, there is an increase in atrial pressure. So within the atria, there's increased pressure, which makes sense since they're contracting. Okay, and then we get to the period of isovolumetric contraction. So the QRS complex has initiated ventricular contraction, but the valve is not yet, the AV valve is closed, but the mitral, aortic valve is not yet open, so there's just a buildup of pressure. And there's this rapid buildup of pressure here, and you see that with the red line here, that's ventricular pressure rapidly increasing. It's not appreciably affecting anything else, and you notice there's no change in the volume of the ventricle, really. It's just increasing the pressure. Okay. And then once the valve pops open, here, now we're in the period of rapid ejection of the ventricular systole. And so now the ventricle volume will decrease as it contracts, and the ventricular pressure and the aorta pressure will increase markedly here. Okay. As you go through there, you just see it increases during the period of rapid ejection. And then what they call reduced ejection, as it's kind of finalizing its ejection phase. And now we see all the blood has been ejected from the ventricles. And now this is the point at which the second heart sound comes, the dub, which is the closing of the aortic valve or the pulmonary valve. And there's a momentary increase in pressure because that valve flaps shut, and now there's an increase in pressure within there before it then passively reduces as we go through there. So the blood then flows out of the pulmonary artery and the aorta. And then finally, we're back into a period of rapid ventricular filling. So then all the blood from the periphery is now flowing through the atria and into the ventricles. And then it just keeps flowing through there, through the rest of diastole. And so the whole thing is a coordinated wave of activity, as you can see here. In, increased pressure, out it goes, and it's flowing in, and then goes back out. Okay. All right. Questions on the pressures, the valves, the flow? Can we get the lights again, please? Okay. All right. Now, remember the slide quite some time ago about metabolic demand and how it would increase with activity. What really matters then is how much blood is being moved per unit of time. And the metric for that is cardiac output, and it's a simple equation. It's heart rate times stroke volume. So you'll have greater greater cardiac output if you have more beats per minute and if each beat has a larger expulsion of blood, so a larger stroke volume. So if your heart doesn't beat fast enough or your ejection fraction, your stroke volume is not large enough, then you won't be getting as much blood. So this is usually in either milliliters per minute or liters per minute. Now, in terms of heart rate, or what we call cardiac chronotropy, chrono for time, heart rate is regulated, as I said, extrinsically, because if we denervated it from external influences, it would beat on its own intrinsic rhythm of about 105 beats per minute. And the primary influence here is vagal, or parasympathetic, nervous system. So the vagal nerve is the 10th cranial nerve, and it's the main efferent and afferent branch of the parasympathetic nervous system. So it has both efferent activity, for example, a slow heart rate, and afferent activity to receive inputs from the various target organs, so it knows how to adapt those. I'm a little anthropomorphic, but so that it can adaptively respond to the conditions in the target organs. So it's going to slow heart rate, but so too would if you just used any, if you put acetylcholine on the SA node, that would slow it, because there's a cholinergic synapse there. So the parasympathetic nervous system, where it meets the SA node, has acetylcholine as the transmitter that allows for the vagal influence on heart rate. And in quiet conditions, seated conditions, most laboratory conditions, most of the changes in heart rate below 100 beats a minute are going to be primarily driven by the parasympathetic nervous system. Not to say the sympathetic nervous system does nothing, but a majority of the action will be due to parasympathetic or vagally controlled. It'll be vaguely controlled. Now, the sympathetic nervous system also has an influence on heart rate, and as you might expect, it would speed heart rate, but its impact is not nearly as strong as the parasympathetic input on heart rate. And its main effect, the sympathetic nervous system's main effect, is changes in contractility, or the technical term for that would be inotropy. Okay. Inotropy, I-N-O-tropy. Okay. So, but if you were looking at heart rate alone, and if people were in the laboratory, you would be justified in saying, okay, a lot of the changes I'm seeing are parasympathetically driven, but you couldn't infer that unequivocally they were parasympathetically driven. So heart rate is a measure that's going to mix parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system influences. So it's not going to be a pure measure. But despair not, there are ways to try to get around that that we'll unpack here in just a moment. So this is just a cartoon diagram showing the control. So here we have the SA node of the heart. The rest of the heart is just a kind of a black box at this point. And we see here the 10th cranial nerve, the vagal nerve, which terminates here on the SA node, and it's a cholinergic synapse. So there'll be cholinergic neurotransmission going on there. It means that any anticholinergic drugs are going to inhibit the influence of the vagus. Anticholinergics are things that antidepressants are anticholinergic, so we would expect an increased heart rate, all else being equal, when people are on those kinds of drugs. Now, the sympathetic nervous system influence is going to come from several of the neurons here in the spinal ganglia of the sympathetic chain here, and they will all terminate also on the SA node, but they're terminal transmitter is norepinephrine rather than acetylcholine. So some studies, which I won't have a chance to talk about today, have tried to parse apart vagal and non-vagal influences, or parasympathetic and sympathetic influences, by using drugs that selectively block acetylcholine or selectively block norepinephrine to try to look at changes in heart rate that would then presumably be due to one or the other system. So if we block norepinephrine, then we can be reasonably confident that any changes we see are due to parasympathetic influence, and if we block acetylcholine, then presumably we see changes due to norepinephrine. Need to change the tape?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so the tenth, this tenth nerve is the vagal nerve, and the ninth is the glossopharyngeal nerve, and it has some feedback circuits. What's also on this diagram, this is the baroreceptor, the feedback unit that we'll talk about in a minute, that allows neurons in the brainstem to respond to conditions in the heart, to adaptively regulate heart rate depending on the pressure that's sensed there.
So that norepinephrine pathway, you're saying that's sympathetic?
Yes, that's sympathetic. Now, the sympathetic is a little more complicated in that, remember, both the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system had a synapse in between the central nervous system neuron and the target organ. So this one exits the central nervous system, but there's still a synapse here. This is acetylcholine. Also, the parasympathetic nervous system also has an interneuron here, but it's much closer to the target organ. That was the difference between the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system that we talked about a couple of times ago. It has acetylcholine in both places. Okay.
So is that what we're talking about when it said like acetylcholine should block everything because
anticholinergics are going to also inhibit indeed some of the effects of the sympathetic nervous system by virtue of blocking some of this. That's right. But they're going to have a greater impact on the parasympathetic control of the heart. Okay, so this just shows a different version of it. This one comes from the chapter in your text, showing that there would be central source neurons, control neurons, in the brainstem, unspecified in this diagram. We'll talk about them in a little bit, but for example, the dorsal motor nucleus and the nucleus ambiguus for the parasympathetic nervous system. And the sympathetic, they're also central source neurons. And then there's acetylcholine between the central source neurons and the peripheral ganglia. But where they differ here is at the target, at the SA node. Cholinergics for parasympathetic and norepinephrine for the sympathetic nervous system.
So what were you saying about the
DMS? I'll come back to those. Those are just some of the central source neurons for the parasympathetic nervous system. So like the dorsal motor nucleus or the nucleus ambiguus are part of that control system. What? Take them as it's complicated. Okay. All right. Now, if we look at then what... Ignore the bottom half of the diagram for just a moment. We might be interested then in what does the sympathetic and what does the parasympathetic nervous system do in terms of overall cardiac output. So the parasympathetic nervous system, as we've talked about, has a negative chronotropic effect. When it's more active, then heart rate is going to go down. So decrease heart rate. The sympathetic nervous system is going to have a positive chronotropic effect, but not as large as the parasympathetic effect, and so that would serve to increase heart rate. So depending on the relative activity, heart rate can go up and down, which is going to contribute to cardiac output. And then stroke volume is going to be affected by some peripheral factors, but also here by central sympathetic nervous system activity, and it has a positive inotropic effect, so it's going to increase contractility. That means it's going to have, all else being equal, a larger stroke volume. So when the sympathetic nervous system becomes active, we can increase heart rate and increase stroke volume, and that's a great way to increase cardiac output. Parasympathetic nervous system activity would have to decrease in order for heart rate to go up, and that can also increase cardiac output. But the sympathetic system will work both in terms of contractility, stroke volume, as well as heart rate. So it can have two influences on cardiac output. Now, it's not just that one is on and one is off. We talked about, although they work in generally antagonistic fashion, there's quite a coordinated dance that has to happen for these two systems to have influence on our target organ, and the heart is a great example of that. So this is a study from the late 60s by Levy and Zeisky, looking at heart rate change when they actually stimulated the vagus and stimulated the sympathetic nerves that innervated the heart. And the numbers here equal the number of pulses per second. So This is vagal stimulation at 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 pulses per second. So they're stimulating the vagus. As a function of the amount of stimulation going on in the sympathetic nerve as well. So when there's no sympathetic activity, kind of what you expect, heart rate, when there's no vagal activity, no sympathetic activity, that's arbitrarily baseline to be 0. Okay, so it's easy to interpret. And as vagal firing increases, then heart rate decreases. And you see a rather substantial decrease in heart rate. But what's interesting is that as sympathetic firing rates are increased, you know, again, they increase heart rate when vagal control, when there's no vagal control here at 0. But the slope of this is even steeper when there is more sympathetic activation. So another way of saying that is that when the sympathetic activity is high, the influence of the vagus is even greater. It has a greater difference between no firing and 8 pulses per second. Okay. These same data are translated over here, putting now sympathetic frequency on the x-axis and the different lines being the amount of vagal activity. So what we see again, when there's no sympathetic activity, no vagal activity, we have a rate change of 0. It's baseline. And that when there's no vagal control, you can see that sympathetic firing frequency, as you go from 0 to 4, does increase heart rate, as you might expect. But when there's vagal control, it's dampened or almost eliminated. Okay. And so another way of saying that is that the vagal control can predominate over the sympathetic control. If both are highly active, the vagus appears to win. So this was a pretty dramatic demonstration. Some of this effect is likely due to using heart rate here as the metric. The other thing you could use is heart period. So not, you know, the rate in terms of, you know, beats per minute, but the interval between successive R spikes. So of course, heart rate and interbeat interval are reciprocals of each other, but it's not a linear relationship. And Bernstein, Quigley, and Lozano in their chapter have about a paragraph where they talk about that heart period, that is the distance in milliseconds between R spikes, is probably a preferred metric, and these effects don't appear quite as dramatic when you use heart period. Okay. But there still is this kind of interaction between them, where you know you can't know the influence of one system without knowing the activity level of the other system. Okay. Now, this is the way that it's conceptualized in the text, just another way of looking at this kind of idea. So the naive, simple, outdated, invalid conceptualization is up here. Okay. It's a continuum. You're the parasympathetic or sympathetic. Obviously far too simple. So they're talking here about a cardiac autonomic space where you can look at heart period now instead of heart rate, so heart period being longer or shorter, as a function of the amount of parasympathetic activity from low to high and sympathetic activity from low to high. And you see, you know, generally what you'd expect is, you know, when there is low sympathetic activity and high parasympathetic activity, there's a long time between beats. It's a slow heart rate. And when you have low parasympathetic activity and high sympathetic activity, then there's a short time between heartbeats, or it's a fast heart rate. And, you know, there's all kinds of places along this space, and these 3D diagrams are always hard to see, but it's not exactly a flat plane, and it's not perfectly parallel to the ground, because you know there are interactions where vagal control predominates over sympathetic control. Okay. And what is also important to note is it's not just that when parasympathetic comes on, sympathetic shuts off. That would be this reciprocity notion, but there can also be coactivity where both are low or both are high, and they'll have effects on cardiac function. Okay. Now, in terms of understanding then how this is dynamically achieved, and from beat to beat, there are even changes in the timing of the cardiac cycle. This is dependent upon the baroreceptor reflex. And the baroreceptors are pressure-sensitive receptors that are located in the arch of the aorta and the carotid sinus nerves. The carotid sinus nerves, I don't think, should be on there. And they send their afferent information to regulatory centers in the brainstem, in the medulla. And so with an increase, they're pressure receptors. So when there's an increase in blood pressure, then there would be a need to decrease heart rate. And when there's a decrease in blood pressure, there would be a need to increase heart rate. If you didn't, cardiac output would plummet and you'd faint. And so this is a dynamic system that continuously adjusts to maintain an optimal level of blood pressure. And so it can sense the amount of blood pressure that's there and adjust heart rate accordingly. So it quickly adjusts to do so. We saw just a hint of this in a cartoon diagram a couple back here. So here's the carotid the cardiac baroreceptor here, and it's sending its input back to the centers in the brainstem that can dynamically adjust to change heart rate here through the vagal control. Okay, so that's a good system, and it's a system that works very well, but you can fool the system sometimes, and the Valsalva maneuver is an example of that. You probably don't know this by the Valsalva maneuver unless you've studied this before, but it's a maneuver where you close the epiglottis and you increase thoracic pressure. You might do this when you're lifting weights. You might do this on the commode. There are various things that people might do this. You might do this if you're playing a musical instrument that's hard to blow. Okay? But any one of these things then will increase thoracic pressure. Okay? And this Valsalva maneuver is a great way to test the integrity of this system. So you can have somebody sit there and try to blow with their mouth and throat closed, and they will increase their pressure, and you'll see changes in this that I'll unpack here in just a second. Okay? Now, in healthy individuals, this is harmless. There's no harm in doing this. You'll see changes in pressure, which then also translate to changes in rate, and it's a dynamic adjustment. In people with cardiac pathology, this, though, can be dangerous, as a matter of fact. Okay. In fact, I don't know if you know this, but one place that people die more often than you'd expect is on the toilet seat. And people who have cardiac pathology, if they're doing the Valsalva maneuver, will die right there. Doesn't show up in the obituaries usually. Okay. So, and this just shows the baroreceptor reflex a little more schematically. So these baroreceptor afferents here send their information to the medulla, specifically the nucleus tractus solitarius, the NTS. And then this is going to send output both to the parasympathetic and the sympathetic motor neurons, but it has a positive effect on parasympathetic. So if there's an increase in pressure, then there's an increase, it makes the parasympathetic motor neurons more likely to fire. They would increase their firing, which is then going to, of course, decrease heart rate. So increased pressure, increased firing of the parasympathetic nervous system neurons, and therefore decreased heart rate. In terms of the sympathetic side, from the nucleus tractus solitarius, there's a negative relationship with the ventrolateral medulla, which in turn then has a positive relationship the rest of the way down, so that as pressure increases, there will be decreased activity in the ventral lateral medulla, the sympathetic motor neurons, and decreased output to the heart, meaning there would not be a heart rate increase due to sympathetic neurons. Okay. That's when you see baroreceptor afferents showing increased pressure. So here's a diagram of what would happen to heart rate as a function of blood pressure. When blood pressure is low, heart rate is higher, and then as blood pressure increases, there's this kind of a not quite linear, but over a broad range, linear decrease in heart rate as a function of increased blood pressure.
Mm-hmm. How come really fit people have low blood pressure and low resting heart rate?
Presumably, so the question is, why do really fit people have low blood pressure and low resting heart rate? They would probably have very high stroke volume, so cardiac output can be maintained. So the system is going to have to adapt, not just to some absolute pressure. I'm not quite sure what the mechanism of that's going to be, but the system needs to maintain, the adequate cardiac output. So if you have a large stroke volume from exercise, for example, you might have, hearts can be larger in a healthy way, not an enlarged heart in an unhealthy way. Stroke volume can be bigger, then heart rate can be lower. And the blood pressure effects are going to also have to do with the degree of elasticity of the aorta as well as the peripheral vasculature. Okay, so here is the Valsalva maneuver illustrated in terms of heart rate and in terms of aortic pressure. And so this can be used to assess autonomic reflex control. And if, you know, you are worried about the cardiac health of your subject, you'd only want to do this with a physician standing nearby. But if you're not worried about them, you can, you know, do it with your roommate at home. And you have a subject conduct a maximal forced expiration against a closed glottis, okay, and doing this for at least 10 seconds. That's just a way of, you know, hold your breath and push at the same time. So take a big deep breath in and push against resistance. So when that's done, the contraction of the thoracic cage begins to compress the lungs and causes a large increase in intrathoracic pressure. Okay. And when it does that, of course, it also compresses some of the vessels within the thoracic cage, including the aorta. So here's the onset and the offset of the Valsalva maneuver, of that chest compression. So you see there's a rapid increase in aortic pressure here, and that's going to have a compensatory decrease in heart rate initially. And that's the baroreceptors at work. But of course that doesn't maintain because the thoracic vena cava are also compressed. So there's a decrease now in the amount of blood returning to the heart. And so the venous return to the heart is compromised. And so there's a fall in cardiac output. So now, you know, so initially high pressure, decreased heart rate, but now there's decreased venous return and decreased heart rate. Cardiac output's down, so the heart rate comes back up and actually goes above baseline here. And then after several seconds, this is reduced back to baseline levels, but again, heart rate increased, okay, here. And then finally, when the subject begins breathing again, there's a sudden loss of compression on the aorta, which can cause a small transient dip in pressure, a small transient increase in heart rate here. And then the compression of the vena cava removed, there's a large influx of blood to the heart. That can be the stressful part for people who have cardiac pathology. There's a rapid increase in aortic pressure when all that blood is then pushed out, and a compensatory decrease in heart rate before the whole system finally stabilizes here. So you see these dynamic adjustments due to pressure changes, and it's a good way to test the integrity of the system. Okay. Does that make sense to people? Any questions? Okay. So I'm thinking this is probably a good time for a break, and we'll come back in 15 minutes.
I've never run one of these before.
Are you having a credit
card? All right. Everybody's back. That works pretty well, I have to say. Okay. So, I wanted to pick up talking about one of the measures of this integrated control mechanism and one of the measures we use often to look at vagal control of the heart. And we can do that because in addition to these dynamic changes related to pressure, the dynamic changes related to the Valsalva maneuver, there's an ongoing periodic dynamic regulation that's related to respiration. So there's something known as respiratory sinus arrhythmia. This kind of arrhythmia is a good thing. You want to have this because it shows that your system is dynamically adapting each and every time you breathe in and you breathe out. So heart rate accelerates when you inspire. Heart rate will go up, and then you breathe out, and heart rate goes back down. And so although we talk about heart rate as something across a whole minute, like your heart rate's 70 beats a minute, it can oscillate quite a bit from moment to moment, from breath to breath, as a function of breathing. Now, why that occurs is a matter of some debate. One of the things we know is that this is a potentially an evolutionary strategy for maximizing the exchange of oxygen. That when you breathe in and the lungs are filled with oxygen, you want as much blood flowing through there as possible to maximize oxygen exchange. And the heart doesn't need to pump as quickly at other times when the lungs are not as full of oxygen. So there's certainly that argument. Probably has to do with pressure changes in the thoracic cavity as well, although I've not seen this talked about, but I would expect as you increase the volume of the cavity, there may be a decrease in aortic pressure that should then cause a compensatory increase in heart rate, and then when the cavity decreases in size, there's an increase in pressure, and then heart rate will drop again. But importantly for psychophysiological research, then an index of this arrhythmia that's linked to respiration can provide an index of the strength of vagal control. So it's the strength of the vagal break. So if you think about somebody who has strong vagal inhibition, when they breathe in, there'll be a release of that break and there should be a large increase in heart rate. And then when they breathe out, there'll be a large reinstatement. So it'd be big breath-to-breath variability in terms of heart rate. Whereas somebody who has relatively poor vagal control or lower vagal control, their heart rate overall should be higher, but of course heart rate, remember, is both sympathetic and parasympathetically influenced. Their heart rate would be higher, but then when you remove the break, there'd be a smaller increase, and you reinstate the break, it's not such a strong vagal break, there'd be a smaller decrease. So there'd be less variation from breath to breath in somebody with lower vagal control. So breathing becomes a probe that interrupts the vagal control. And we can see how strong that vagal control is by looking at the amount of change in heart rate, or more specifically, change in interbeat interval from one breath to another. But we'll have more to say about that later. Non-invasively, no. There are many indices you can derive of RSA, so you'll see no shortage of metrics, but they're all based on timing of the heart rate with respect to respiration. Okay. The trouble with recording invasively is that if you goof it up, you could end up shutting down a person's heart because you'd be trying to record in the vagus that itself is having an influence on heart rate. And you could cause major problems. Don't try it at home. Okay, now in terms of cardiac inotropy, for contractility, that's predominantly sympathetically mediated. Okay, and this is often measured invasively, but it can be measured non-invasively as well. And you can either use a combination of measures using the EKG as well as a phonocardiogram, which we'll talk about in a little bit, just listening to heart sounds, or you can use something known as impedance cardiography, where you pass a low amperage current, a high frequency low amperage current through the chest cavity. Not enough to be harmful, obviously, and then you can measure changes in impedance that's related to blood flow. But I'll unpack both of those in a little bit. Okay. So now, if you just heard that, you say, oh great, we have a measure of parasympathetic control, we have a measure of sympathetic control, now we know everything that's going on. But the sympathetic measures I was talking about were inotropic, they weren't chronotropic. And so you're really looking at chronotropic measures on the one hand and inotropic measures on the other. So they're relatively easy to measure, RSA and other metrics of HRV for parasympathetic nervous system contractility using one of the methods I alluded to for sympathetic nervous system influence, but since one measures chronotropy, the other measures inotropy, you could have changes in contractility independent of changes in rate. You could have changes of rate independent of changes in contractility. Moreover, the sympathetic nervous system inputs for inotropy are primarily controlled by left-sided inputs, and the sympathetic nervous systems for chronotropy are primarily controlled by right-sided inputs. So in the end, you wouldn't want to make too strong a statement comparing sympathetic and parasympathetic influences on certainly heart rate based upon measures of inotropy and measures of chronotropy. Okay. It'd be a classic apples and oranges kind of problem. So, I mean, they're perfectly fine measures of what they are, but I don't think that looking at these, one set of measures of inotropy and the other of chronotropy, you could really look at the integrated control, comparing apples and oranges. But I have to mention, you can compare apples and oranges as well. As illustrated here, this is the infrared transmission spectra of a Granny Smith and Sunkist navel orange. You can see the apple has more transmittance than the orange across all frequency bands. So you can certainly compare apples and oranges. All right. So this is not an exhaustive list of cardiac measures, but it'd be a useful toolbox. If you could record all of these, you'd be pretty well set to do a lot of work in electrophysiology laboratory. So we'll talk about each of these in turn, spending a little more time on some than on others. So the EKG, or the ECG, the electrocardiogram, is where we'll start. This is an easy signal to measure because the cardiac signal is large. It's almost hard not to measure it when you're measuring other things. You'll see EKGs bleeding into EMGs, EKGs bleeding into EEG, if you're not careful. There are different configurations you can use of two electrodes as long as they span the heart. So there are three configurations listed here according to the Eindhoven's triangle. Eindhoven here, one of the early EKG guys. And they're called lead 1, 2, and 3. And lead 1 would be from arm to arm, on either side of the chest that way. Lead 2 would be right arm to left leg, and lead 3, left arm to left leg. Any one of them can produce a reasonable EKG signal. We usually record lead 1 arm to arm. Subjects just seem a little less suspicious if you're not trying to record from their leg. They all work perfectly fine. We record the signal and we sample it somewhere around 500 times a second so that we have a sample every couple of milliseconds and we can get a precise index of the timing. It's a very faint black text that I'll bet it absolutely doesn't show up. It says AC signal, sample it at 200 to 500 hertz. But if you're going to be doing any work with EKG, you probably want to sample it closer to 500 hertz. Okay. This is another way of looking at the Eindhoven's triangle. This diagram comes from the text. And again, you can see the same three leads, lead 1, lead 2, and lead 3. And these are what are called cardiac vectors, kind of the direction that you would see the signal in a maximal way. So the P wave and the R wave are going to have maximal kind of pickup over here. So if we had a lead 3 configuration, those would be pretty good. The Q vector is this particular way, but this right arm, right, left arm lead will pick up really all of them because this is just the direction. There's also kind of a negative and a positive. So this would be positive the direction of the arrow, negative the other way. So you can pick it up at any one of these different leads. Okay. So let's just do a little bit of demonstration of recording EKG. So who'd like to be a volunteer today? You want to volunteer again? Okay. I want to spread around. Okay, so let's have Lisa.
I'm going to
press her. Press her? Okay. Get a lot of data. Okay. Yeah. All right. So once again, I'm going to use this little portable system that we had before. And there we go. This is the J&J system. And in the lab, you'll be using the BioPAC system again. And because we're recording a signal that originates within the body and the outer layer of skin, remember the horny layer of skin is dead skin cells, that provides a lot of resistance to the signal. So in the lab, you're going to learn how to, what we politely call, abrade the skin, which you do enough to get a good contact and not enough to hurt the subject. But this system actually is pretty decent. It's got a high signal-to-noise ratio, and I don't have to do any abrasion here. These are actually gel-free contacts. This is just water from the bathroom faucet. And might be one of these. And here, put it on a wristband. Here, one and two.
Go backstage.
Yeah. All right. Let me just slide one into there. And one into there. Okay, so hopefully that'll work. Okay. If you want to turn so you can see it, you're welcome to. Okay, yeah, you can see it here. So this right now, all we have is, these are just impedance tests. You can see the two leads I put on with a little bit of water, and they've got a pretty good signal. So we're able to get a decent signal with these leads. So, here, and in a moment you're going to see three signals, but one of the signals isn't operative because I didn't hook it up. The first one is the EKG. Now, her heart's upside down. Right? Now, polarity is arbitrary. If I switch those two leads around, you'd see the EKG waveform in the way that you've been seeing it over and over again. Very pronounced R spike, good T wave, And there it is. Her heart rate is estimate online is somewhere around 100 beats per minute or so. That's just the ongoing estimate. This middle chart here, which we'll update in a minute, when I first plugged it in, it was estimating a heartbeat of 50 beats per minute just because it didn't have any input. And then as soon as she started, we got a signal. You can see that there are dynamic changes in heart rate, and I would suspect each of these is a respiratory cycle. Okay. Now once it comes up to the next screen, this will scale a little bit better, and we'll be able to see these changes a little bit more dynamically. There it comes. All right. Well, maybe it won't scale. Let's see. Okay. There we go. So now just focus on doing some nice, deep, relaxing breaths. And you can see dynamically, now this is heart rate, it's not intermediate interval, but it's more intuitive. Your heart rate goes up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. So it's very, it's really quite dynamic. You feel up to a Valsalva maneuver? Okay. Take a deep breath, close your glottis, and push your thoracic cavity in. And do this for 10 seconds. Okay. So you can see there was a heart rate deceleration, then the acceleration, then the compensatory deceleration. Well, your system's working. That's good. Okay. Oh, there was, that was an artifact, so just it didn't know what to do with it. So it said her heart rate went up to 180 beats a minute, but that's the kind of thing that is critical to edit your data for, because if you're looking at heart rate variability, one wrong beat of 180 beats per minute that's not valid will make it look like she has a lot of variability when in fact it's not there. Okay. As mentioned last time, this system has a little biofeedback component built in. Let's see what it does with heart rate variability. Maybe nothing. Apparently nothing. I didn't try that one beforehand, but you could imagine the kind of biofeedback again with heart rate going up and down as well. So it's a very simple signal to get, as you can see. But now why don't you just tap your foot like you're just kind of antsy, you're ready to get your credits and get out of here. And without getting any artifacts, maybe we'll see your heart rate's already gone up to 110 beats per minute. So the one thing you have to be aware of when recording heart rate is that the heart is highly responsive to the physical state of the individual. And so if this were in any way, if you were doing this under one condition, not another, or certain kind of subjects are more likely to be moving, we're going to see changes that are not due to the psychological conditions, but due to the physiological state of the person. Any other ideas for what to do with their heart rate? What? Relax?
What happens if you close your neck with pulse? Doesn't that do something?
Yeah. You're going to faint if you push your neck too much, right?
Well,
it's
difficult. Doesn't
that make a
change?
It should. So there's less oxygen getting to the brain, so I would assume that you should see an increase in heart rate, but I don't know that for sure.
Can you make
a sneeze? Can I make a sneeze? Oh, you want to see if her heart stops? According to the urban legends, the heart does not stop when you sneeze. It's a well-known fact. The heart does not stop when you sneeze. Although we'd probably get a big artifact that might look like it went 180 beats a minute again, but that would be about it. Okay.
What happens if she just takes a big breath and holds it, no pressure?
Okay, so take a big breath, hold it. So initially it responds like another breath, but then I bet if she holds it long enough, there should be an increase in heart rate because there's lower oxygen. Yep, look at that. It's going up and up and up. Okay. Right. So it squashes variability, and then there's an increase in heart rate. And those will usually go together, that when there's going to be a suppression of variability and an increase in heart rate, both are signs that the parasympathetic nervous system influence is decreased.
What happens if she breathes really quickly, like pounce?
You might see faster oscillations in the RSA unless she's going too fast for it to respond. But you could, why don't you breathe a little more quickly, like once every 3 seconds or so. In, out. In, out. In, out. So you see the variability is suppressed quite a bit. And that's potentially a confound with this measure of RSA, is that rate, under some conditions, this is a very good measure of vagal control, but it also is sensitive to a respiration rate, and also to a lesser extent depth, that may dissociate the index of RSA from central vagal control. So some people suggest pacing breathing while their subjects are doing tasks. I'm not personally that big a fan of it, because it's a dual task then. So as long as their breathing stays within a fairly reasonable range, and in laboratory situations that's usually the case, it's probably okay. But it's probably one of the most controversial areas in this field, is what to do with breathing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right. So, she's smiling, good. Hold it. Right. Okay, good. Now,
I don't think I'm going to be able to do it anymore.
Okay, why don't you try thinking of the face you'd have when you're really irritated with somebody. Yeah. I don't know what irritates you, some driver cutting you off, some instructor putting you on the spot, but, whatever you did, your heart rate went way down and the variability went up.
I guess I calmed down when I'm irritated.
Good. All right.
Doesn't that have anything to do with laughing versus sighing? You were laughing when you were smiling, but when you're irritated, you're sighing.
Yeah. Deep breathing, yeah. If you have a deep breath out, you should see a compensatory decrease in heart rate. Mm-hmm.
How different are these among, in individual differences when you look at the heart rate?
Oh, very, very different. I'll show you some examples here in a few subsequent slides of how.
But if someone else were hooked up, would the distance between the curves be very different?
Well, so the respiration rate could differ, but also, and so the timing between these ups and downs would differ. Also, the overall mean level would differ. As Lisa said, she tends to have a high heart rate. You'd also see differences in the amplitude of this. So for some people, it'd be quite squashed compared to other people. And those are individual differences that then we quantify.
Well, do I have good vagal control?
Well, just eyeballing it, it's hard to say. It's very responsive, so I'm assuming yes. But I don't know quantitatively where you stand on the distribution. But it's
and
very.
So how are you figuring that out relative?
Well, with each and every breath, you didn't need the. So this is the respiration sensor that I didn't hook up, which makes it look like she's not breathing, right? But you don't need that. You can see she's breathing. It's very regular. You can see the respiration pattern just clearly by looking at the heart rate. So her baroreceptor reflex circuit is working very, very well. She's got respiratory sinus arrhythmia. The heart rate is very well timed to the breathing. Now, since I can't on the spot convert this to IBIs and do some kind of variance estimate, I don't know where it stands in terms of the mean. But, I've certainly seen people where you just don't see this. It just virtually unchanged, or the changes you see aren't tied to respiration. And I'll show you a graph of that in a little bit. Okay, well, thank you very much. Okay, let me stop this before I unplug you. Okay. Let me just take those 80s bands off. Thank you. Okay. Okay. So I've alluded to the fact that you can express this either in terms of heart rate or in terms of interbeat interval, and this has led to some discussion of, you know, what time base should we use? Should we use real time, which is heart rate, expressed as beats per minute, which is the usual metric, or should we use cardiac time, which is heart period, that is the distance between beats, the interbeat interval, IBI, and that would be expressed in milliseconds. Okay. Now they are related to each other by a simple conversion, that heart rate in beats per minute is 1 over heart period in milliseconds times 60,000, so 60,000 milliseconds in a minute. So, just to show you the formula really works, if you have 1,000 milliseconds between beats, that would be 60 beats a minute, and the math makes it work out to 60 beats per minute. Okay. Now, the heart rate is more intuitive, you know. Numbers going up is faster, numbers going down is slower. People have some sense of the metric, you know, how fast your heart beats at rest, you know, how fast your heart beats when you exercise. But heart period is better behaved for statistical analyses, and it's also much more closely linked to the efferent activity changes in the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. So it's more, if you're looking for some linear relationship between your metric and your central nervous system activity, or your autonomic nervous system activity, you'd want to use heart period, so that, you know, linear changes in parasympathetic output would have linear changes in heart period, but not linear changes in heart rate. So heart period is generally preferred, although if you're interested in just fixed changes with respect to some stimulus, you're looking over a time window, then using real-time measures of heart rate can be fine. So you present a emotional picture and you look for heart rate changes, heart rate is a measure that's perfectly fine for that. If you're looking though at something like heart rate variability, you'd want to use heart period. Alright, another measure is phonocardiography, and as the name implies, it's just a sound measuring system where you position a microphone over the heart. You actually have to position it between a couple of ribs to get the right sound, and then it picks up the heart sounds and transduces them to an electrical signal, and then it just comes in as a signal like any other signal that you'd be recording using your recording device, and so you've got your heart sounds, lub and dub, respectively. Now, you wouldn't do this alone, but it is a useful measure in combination with the EKG for deriving some of the estimates of the timing of contraction, and I'll show you that in just a little bit. That's pretty simple. Another measure is photoplethysmography, and this is a measure of peripheral blood flow, and this measure involves shining some infrared light into the tissue bed. And there's three methods here. There's transilluminated where the light's on top and the recording cell is on the bottom, and there's backscattered where the light and the cell are adjacent to each other in this other fiber optic method. They're all involve measuring the light that's absorbed by the peripheral vasculature. So living tissue is relatively transparent to IR light, but blood is opaque to IR light. So as blood flow changes in the tissue bed, there'll be changes in the amount of light that's reflected back to the sensor. So with each, you know, change in blood flow, you'll be able to detect changes in this signal. And the photocell just converts that light energy to an electrical signal. It's a special transducer. So your signal then looks something like this. These are data collected with a BioPAC system, and so you see, you know, each one of these is a beat. So this is the start here, the increase in pressure once the aortic valve opens, because we're not measuring in the heart now, we're measuring in the periphery. So once the aortic valve opens, there's an increase in peripheral pressure, and then it peaks and it starts to fall, but there's a little blip here, right here, when the aortic valve closes. It's called the dicrotic notch. It's at the end of ejection. So you can see it's, you know, this very regular signal. And this distance from the opening of the aortic valve to the closing of the aortic valve, the end of ventricular contraction, is going to be a very rough approximation of left ventricular ejection time, which would be sympathetically controlled. But it's very rough, in fact too rough to use for scientific purposes. And part of the reason for that is that there'll be other influences on the timing of that, including peripheral resistance due to constriction of the vasculature that can change the timing of that distance. So it's not going to be an exact measure of timing, it's just going to be an approximate measure of that timing. Yes.
How is the, I can't say it, related to the oxygen saturation thing for
mm-hmm.
you?
The oxygen saturation is also an infrared sensor, and I imagine, I don't know for sure, I imagine that the oxygenated blood has a different absorption coefficient than the deoxygenated blood, and so you're going to be able to detect small changes in the amount of that. I have seen the signal on that thing, and it also, you get this kind of signal as well, but then they're deriving another metric from it, but it still must have to do with the amount of light that's absorbed versus reflected. Okay. Another measure of interest, and you can also look at peripheral vasoconstriction. So the photoplethysmograph can be an interesting way to measure peripheral vasoconstriction, which would be a function of arousal and sympathetic arousal. This is the same signal presented two different ways. The lower panel is the raw signal. There's been no filtering applied to this signal. The upper panel, which is now on a different metric, has had a high-pass filter applied. So remember, high-pass filters are going to filter out these slow frequency drifts, or at least attenuate them. So this one is just the oscillation. So this is some stimulus that occurs here at time one, and what you can see is two things. Overall, there is a decrease in blood volume in the periphery, so that the whole level goes down, and visible in both traces is that the peak-to-peak of the photoplethysmograph signal is diminished. And that would also be an indication of vasoconstriction, because now there's less change in the amount of blood flowing with each beat. So here, you get fairly large change in blood flow with each and every beat, but once there's vasoconstriction, there's a smaller change in blood flow with each and every beat. So it's an index of sympathetic nervous system vasoconstriction. It can be seen as part of the orienting response as well. Now, if you were interested in very gross measures of heart rate over like a long period of time, you could certainly count all of these and get a heart rate. Again, the timing of this, though, is going to be dependent on other factors, such as peripheral vasoconstriction and resistance, overall blood pressure, and that's going to end up making it unsuitable for actually detecting the timing of the heartbeat. And since the EKG is so easy to get, you wouldn't usually use this anyway. By the way, this can be placed on the finger, on the thumb. Also, something is placed on the earlobe, any number of places. Okay. Now, if we're interested in contractility, then we'd be interested in how rapidly the ventricles contract. So with a more forceful contraction, there'll be a more rapid contraction of the ventricles. But to measure that, we can't get that with the EKG signal alone. We can, however, get that with a combination of the EKG signal as well as the phonocardiogram. And what we're interested in primarily is this measure called PEP, pre-ejection period. And that's going to influence, it's the contractility during isovolumetric contraction. So to get this, you need to derive a few measures. So here we have our lub-dub sounds that are taken by some of the phonocardiogram by the microphone placed between the ribs. This is the aortic pressure. We don't need to have that for this measure. And here is the EKG waveform. So we're interested in PEP. We can't measure it directly, but we can get left ventricular ejection time, which is from the upswing of this pressure wave here, which is with the onset of the QRS complex, all the way to sound 2, okay, to heart sound 2. And then the electromechanical systole is from Q to heart sound 2, so that's the entire time. And if we take the electromechanical systole minus the left ventricular ejection time here, then we can get PEP. And the way that this is derived, they have aortic pressure here, but you can get this not using aortic pressure, but you can use it with a photoplethysmograph, because you can detect the change in pressure that corresponds with the upswing in pressure. Okay? So instead of measuring aortic pressure, you'd use a photoplethysmograph, you'd use a phonocardiogram, and you'd use the EKG signal. And from there, you could get Q to S2 relatively easily with the EKG and the phonocardiogram, and you could get left ventricular ejection time by finding the upswing on the photoplethysmograph signal, which would signal the opening of the valve. And then you take the difference and you get PEP, pre-ejection period. So a shorter PEP is going to be greater contractility and more sympathetic nervous system influence. So this is, until recently, the low budget and way that most labs could do it. The other method is using impedance cardiography, which I'll show you in a bit, which used to be quite expensive, but now is pretty affordable, and you can do it relatively easily. This is admittedly a bit of a pain to score. I had a few people doing this, and they didn't like me very well when they did this. Now, blood pressure would be another thing that you might want to measure. Increases in blood pressure could indicate some general arousal. And unfortunately, continuous measures of blood pressure are much harder to come by. So usually blood pressure is measured, you know, at discrete intervals in time. You've all had it done. There's a cuff that goes on the arm, and it's inflated to a certain amount of pressure. And as it gets, as the pressure in the cuff exceeds the pressure in the artery, the blood flow is occluded. Of course, if you leave it there, your hand starts to sting. It doesn't feel very good. But then you slowly let the pressure off. At some point, the pressure in the cuff equals the pressure in the artery. And then a little bit of blood will start to squish through. I think that's the technical term. It'll squish through. And as it squishes through, it makes Krotkopf sounds, the sound of the blood pulsing through a partially constricted artery. Now, there's a range of pressure in that artery with each and every beat, and it goes from the systolic to the diastolic blood pressure. And as the pressure in the cuff is coming down, it will always be providing some occlusion during some part of the cycle until the cuff pressure is below the diastolic pressure. At that point, the blood will now flow freely. If the blood doesn't flow at all, then there's a range where the cuff is providing some occlusion, and as the blood goes through with each beat, it will make a squishing sound, the Krotkopf sound, and then when it's finally below the diastolic pressure, the blood flows freely again. So by listening for the onset and then also the offset of the Krotkopf sound, then you can note the blood pressure. You note the pressure where they begin, that's the systolic, and the pressure where it ends, and that's the diastolic. And that's the way to do it with a stethoscope and a blood pressure cuff, or those little devices you buy at Walgreens. They just have a little phonocardiogram kind of device, a little sensor in there, and they just pick up the sounds, and then they can detect when it starts and when it stops. So, as I mentioned, this technique, known as the auscultatory technique, is not good for instantaneous readings or for repeated readings. A seldom used but innovative method is ballistocardiography. Ballisto has to do with motion, right? Ballistocardiogram is the motion that is caused by a beating heart. So you might have seen the effects of this when you're just sitting, perhaps with your legs crossed, and you look down and your foot seems to be beating in concert with your heart. And that's the ballistocardiograph effect. So imagine now a hypothetical experiment. We've got an air hockey table, and it's, you know, blowing out lots of air, and you've got a platform nice and big, it's floating on there, and you're sitting on a chair, otherwise motionless. And every time your heart beats, you probably notice there'd be a subtle movement of this on the air hockey table. There'd be a small movement of the platform. So the cardiac events cause this movement. So you can use that kind of technique, if you have a special chair or a platform or any type of thing, to detect a movement that's specifically cardiac related. You have to figure out what does cardiac movement look like compared to people moving around and breathing and all those other things, and filter all that out. But you can look at a telltale signature of heart rate. There's also an interesting article I just saw looking at this use for sleep. So if you want to measure heart rate and heart rate variability during sleep, but you don't have somebody hooked up, you have a special bed that also has kind of a built-in motion sensor. It's called a kinetogram. It's like actigraphy used during sleep. It's a ballistocardiograph method at heart. And so then you can also look at heart rate and heart rate changes during sleep. They noted you couldn't get all night because people are moving and tossing and stuff in bed, you know, throughout segments like that. Now, a couple of other interesting applications of this. It's used in an applied setting. One of these is finding people hiding in vehicles, like at border crossings. The car comes up. All the ostensive occupants get out of the car. The car sits on the platform, and if it still beats at about 60 beats per minute, you might suspect something's in there. Also, it's been used to try to find people in rubble. Now, I'm not quite sure how they do that, because usually you don't have a ballistic cardiogram sensor under the rubble, but there must be some way still of detecting vibrations that come from the heartbeat. So this was just a brief little snippet to show I'm not lying here. This is the CNN talking about it to find people at border crossings. Let's see if this comes up okay. Yep.
Besides prison security, there are several other potential uses for the detector. For example, it's been tested by the U.S. Border Patrol against alien smuggling operations, and
we feel that we can use sensors, different types of sensors, ultrasonics, microwave, and seismic, to be able to find people in earthquake rubble.
There you have it. Let's see, but it doesn't touch the car.
Yeah.
It doesn't touch the car though.
Mm-hmm.
So it couldn't be ballistic cardiogram. And it doesn't go inside the car, so it couldn't be thermal. It'd have to be awfully sensitive to pick up any kind of electrical signal at a distance. Maybe it is picking up motion by if you had a sense, if this thing were still on a stand. Is it handheld? Is it on? I don't think it could be ballistic cardiographic based, because then the holder would also have, the heartbeat. So I'm not sure how that's based.
Would it be possible for there to be something in the car that emits some sort of signal that then which way the people have to signal? So it detects it in the car, and it's a separate signal.
Right. If something's moving, it could make some noise, but it has to be very subtle, so I don't know what it would pick up. Oh, you mean so it's built into the car?
Yeah, but when you're walking, it's supposed to be for, like, if you're working late at the office and you're walking to your car. Like,
oh, I saw the ad during the Super Bowl for this. Yeah,
yeah.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood. I thought this was a device that, any, like, 64 Rambler could pull up and they would be able to tell somebody were in it. So this is... Oh, sure. So this could be a ballistic cardiograph sensor built into the car then, and then it would, and then it would send the information wirelessly to your key fob. Sure, that's probably how it would work, I would guess. Well, if you leave your dog in your car, if it's not tuned to the right heart rate, it would also still tell you to assume some occupant in your car. Okay. Now, impedance cardiography, this is where low energy, high frequency AC current is passed through the thoracic region. By current being low, it's somewhere around 0.1 up to maybe 4 milliamps. So it's a pretty small current. And it's fairly high frequency. It's about 100 kilohertz. So 100,000 hertz. It's quite fast. And changes in the impedance to the signal are created by mechanical events of the cardiac cycle, especially changes in thoracic blood volume. So the red blood cell is the least resistive element in the body, and changes in blood volume in the thoracic cavity then can be easily picked up by changes in resistance or changes in impedance. Impedance is the AC equivalent of resistance. So changes in impedance can be picked up as there are changes in the volume of blood, changes in the volume of the red blood cell. And the current is held constant, and so you're measuring then changes in resistance by detecting changes in voltage. So you're using a simple Ohm's law. By holding voltage current constant, then you can measure changes in resistance by detecting changes in voltage. Now this is nice because it allows direct measurement of pre-ejection period and other indices of sympathetic influence. And you can even calculate an estimate of stroke volume, but it's only an estimate. So these changes in impedance to the signal that are detected, and you get this signal called delta Z, which is change in impedance. And so you can see that there's a decrease, increase, and so on, that regularly occurs coincident with the cardiac cycle. Here's the EKG waveform. And by using the EKG and the delta Z waveform, you can look at the RZ. It's the time from the R wave here to the peak in the Z signal. Okay? And that's going to be an index of ventricular contraction. There's also something called the Heather index. I've not used it, where you look at the first derivative of this signal and divide by the RZ interval, and it's supposed to be an indication of the heart's ability to respond to stress, but I don't know anything more about it than that. So it's an easy way, though, to look at contractility, the timing of contraction in the heart. To record it, you have to have current generators up here, so this constant current oscillator at 100 kilohertz, and then there's two bands down here to pick up. So there's two sending and two receiving bands that go around the thoracic cavity. You use this in your lab, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Only we do, there's four electrodes, one right here,
mm-hmm.
and then one at the end of the sternum.
Okay.
I forget what that is.
The xiphoid process,
yes.
Down here? Uh-huh.
And then there's one on the back, an inch above the lipid,
mm-hmm.
and one on the lower back.
Okay, so you have the two receivers down here and the two
mm-hmm.
senders up here. Right. Okay. And do you usually calculate RZ? Is that your main measure? Okay.
Now I
know. All right. Okay. And do you have to prep the skin at all?
No, we usually don't.
Okay. I would think you probably don't need to, since it's a big signal to detect.
Yeah, we get a pretty strong signal. Lots mm-hmm. of placement.
Right. Okay. So as I said, this used to be a specialized device, but now if you have a BioPAC system, it's just a module you buy. You sell those modules in the lab, you just plug it in, and it's another module, and you get out the delta Z signal from it. Okay. All right. So now I'd like to move towards talking about measuring vagal influence and then a few applications involving heart rate and vagal influence. So I talked already about how there's this descending vagal influence that slows heart rate, and respiration interrupts it. So respiration is a probe that lets us interrupt the ongoing vagal influence. And the size of these periodic oscillations due to respiration can influence the strength of ongoing vagal influence. Now, there can be, under some circumstances, a dissociation between our index of RSA and central cardiac vagal efferent activity. And if you're interested in this, there's a fairly lengthy coverage of it in part of this special issue of Biological Psychology of last year, in particular the article by Grossman and Taylor. There are concerns over people who would... Oh, you need to change the tape? Okay, go ahead. There are concerns over people having changes in rate and, to a lesser extent, depth of respiration. We can measure changes in rate very easily. Just put a strain gauge around the chest. As people inhale, there's greater tension, and as they exhale, there's lesser tension, and that can be transduced into an electrical signal. Changes in depth is harder to measure because it's a relative measure, and changes in placement of that could affect it greatly. So there you have to use something more invasive, usually, to get an index of tidal volume. But as you saw during the demonstration, when she breathed much more rapidly, we didn't see much RSA. Whether or not that actually reflected changes in central vagal outflow is uncertain. But let's take a look at what this looks like. We saw it already, so this isn't anything...
No.
What?
You're in school.
Yeah, you know it. So if you're in the Psychophys lab on Thursday, you're going to get to use this tool. Here we have some EKG data that I recorded some time ago. Heart's also upside down in this one. Right? We got the R spike going down. Doesn't matter the polarity, right? It's just there's a very clear R spike, T wave. A little bit of noise on the signal. It wasn't quite as clean as the one we saw, but it's, for all intents and purposes, pretty easy to find. What we want to do is find each R spike peak and measure the distance between them. This tool was written by Dave Towers, who recently graduated here with his PhD. In response to a lot of kvetching in my lab about the way we were doing it before, we knew there had to be a better way to look at this. So if I wanted to take a look at this, the easiest thing I could do is, say, take some threshold, let's say put it about there, and now I'll say any peak below that I'll call a heartbeat. And actually, I'm going to put it just a little too low so I can show you the process of finding artifacts. So now what I want to do is to look for any peak below the line. and now it's found a whole bunch of peaks. But you see this regular oscillation in interbeat interval, and a couple of very strange things that looked like all of a sudden there was a very long gap, 2,529 milliseconds between beats right here. So there was either some problem with the heart or some problem with our detection of the beats. So if I zoom on in, I pretty quickly see what happened. It just missed a couple of beats. Okay? This is the biggest issue in recording RSA, is identifying beats and artifacts. In fact, Gary Bernson has an article about looking for artifacts in EKG waveforms in measuring RSA, and the subtitle is, after the colon, "Don't miss a beat." Because if you miss a beat, you're going to have a huge index of variability that's not due to vagal control, but just an artifact. So if I go in here and I'll just tell it, go ahead and put a beat where it's supposed to be. Now it looks pretty good. There's another funky thing over here. There we go. And now what you see is respiratory sinus arrhythmia. Now there's something a little funky here. Let's go in and see what's going on there. It's just a very long beat. You can see it's real. So nothing wrong with our detection of it. It's just an exceptionally long beat. So that's what we get there. Now, to get these indices of RSA, there's many different measures of them. I'll just go ahead and calculate some right here using the built-in tool. You'll be doing this in the lab as well. Doing the whole thing, yeah, that looks pretty good. So. Okay, so here's this example. In this 5-minute period, there were 313 IBIs. With a mean IBI of 880 milliseconds, which translates to a mean heart rate of 69 beats per minute. And then there's all these measures of heart rate variability. And different studies use different measures, different investigators use different measures, and this isn't even all possible measures. But I wrote this program just to get most of the measures that were used so that it would be easy to get them from an IBI series. The two I'll call your attention to is there's log of heart rate variability. That's the total variability. That's in any frequency. And there's log RSA. That's variability in the frequency that we would expect would be related to respiration. And that's defined as one breath every 2.5 to 8.3 seconds. That should cover most people's breathing rate. So log HRV is total variance in this series. Let me move this window out of the way. Oh, that window's in the way too. So if I looked at this as a bunch of numbers, I could calculate a mean, I could calculate a standard deviation, calculate a variance. This is the log of the variance of that series. Okay? And then what you don't see here, but I'll show you in another slide, if we that total heart rate variability, RSA is that heart rate variability that's likely due to respiration. So what this tells us is some of the variability here is not tied to respiration. It's due to something else. It's not in the range we'd expect to see for respiration. And most of it is due to respiration, so log RSA. For those of you in lab, we can talk more about what some of the other metrics are as well. So that's what we looked for, and this is the tool that you'll be using.
When you input the missing beats,
yes.
What values, how does it...
Oh, so what I did, I'll go... Ah! Oh, bring it up for a second. Yeah. Like right now, there's no beats in here, but I can put in some beats, and what I do is I tell it, look for a heartbeat at the lowest point in the part that I highlight. So I just highlight it, and it just puts it at the lowest part in each one of these. So I could actually methodically march through this file by hand and put them all in. Right? But what it's doing, the algorithm says, here's a window I'm defining, find the minimum. And if it were the other way around, I could, here's a window, find the maximum. Do that. You can also use a threshold by putting a line and find everything, you know, the peak below the line or the peak above the line.
And so when there was a missing beat?
So when there was a missing beat, what I did, so let me put this line in here again and purposely miss a couple beats. And so find everything below the line. Oops, I guess I have to... it didn't miss them. I'll make it miss them here. I'll get rid of them. Hello. Oh. There we go. So it had missed those two, right? So So when I looked at this whole series, I said, ah, here's some nice respiration-linked variability. And then there was this thing that obviously was problematic. So if I zoom in on it there, I can see what happened was it missed this beat and this beat. So all I wanted to do was tell the program, place a beat here and place a beat here. And, I mean, if I wanted to, I could zoom way, way in, and I could actually just double-click and put the beat there, but that would be pretty laborious. The program's smart enough to know that it will find the peak at the trough of a range that I select. If I go over this one, it'll find the peak at the trough of the range. That's like, okay. So, and then when you zoom out, you see the respiratory length variability. All right. So, looking at heart rate variability, it was considered noise for some time. And there's an interesting history in the article by Porges that I put on the reading list for this year. It's a long article on his polyvagal theory, but it's kind of an interesting one in terms of outlining the history of this measure and his take on respiratory sinus arrhythmia. So, back in the days of behaviorism, heart rate was seen as another behavior, and it should be another behavior that should be under the entire control of the experimenter. You know, if you've done your work right, you've controlled everything, then you should be able to predict response. So heart rate was a dependent variable. And the dominance of behaviorism emphasized control over the dependent variable. So any changes in heart rate that were unrelated to the manipulations of the experimenter were considered noise. They were things that should be eliminated. Okay. Heart rate variability didn't fit into the model of this time. So they thought, you know, if you just design your experiments right, you'll control it out. But in the history of quantifying heart rate variability, it dates way back to the 1950s, including a case study long before that. So the Lacys, who were part of a long tradition of heart rate research, looking at controlling the variables that would influence heart rate, found that greater heart rate variability was associated with greater impulsivity in a 1958 paper. And a case study in 1915 describes somebody with what is called vagotonic syndrome that had clinical features including an exaggerated RSA. So they were already looking at individual differences in this metric nearly a century ago. But the real interest in individual differences in this variable RSA, or respiratory sinus arrhythmia, really starts with the work of Steve Porges in the 70s and developing through the 80s and up to the present day. So this is again what we see. These are two subjects out of 98 that represent the ends of the continuum. This subject has the most RSA, and this subject has the least RSA of these 98 subjects. And this is data plotted in real time of seconds and interbeat interval here. So the overall mean heart rate is not terribly different for the two people, but this person shows much more variability from breath to breath than does this person. Now, if we just took the variance of the time series here, we'd get an index of total heart rate variability, that related to respiration, but also that unrelated to respiration. So by applying a high-pass filter, or a band-pass filter, one that filters out things that are really too slow or too fast to be plausibly related to respiration, we're now looking at only the variability in this signal that's likely due to respiration. Filters, which we'll talk about in detail in a few weeks, end up creating some troubles at the endpoints because they don't have enough data to filter data at the endpoints. You lose a little data at the beginning and the end. But you can see this would match up pretty clearly with this signal here. Looking at this low variability subject, they do have some variability here, but it's very slow. It's too slow to be likely to be related to ongoing respiration. In fact, you can see here's the respiratory influence riding on top of whatever this slow shift is. It could be movement related or something else. So once we filter that, we see here variability that would be in the 0.12 to 0.4 hertz band, or one breath every 2.5 to 8.3 seconds. And that person shows respiratory related changes, but they're much, much smaller than this person. Okay. Another way you can look at this is in terms of kind of a, what's it called? There's a name for this plot that I'm blanking on. No, that's the generic term. It's a special thing they do in non-deterministic research. It's not an entropy plot, but you plot beat n against beat n plus 1. So you're looking at the kind of dynamic relationship of one event to the next event. So this is beat n plus 1, and now you know, beat n plus 1 also becomes another beat n, and there's another beat n plus 1. So you're just plotting the data in that way. If you took two columns of data and shifted them by one and then plotted the scatter plot, you'd get this. If there's a lot of beat-to-beat change, then these should form a big cloud like they do here. But if there's very little beat-to-beat change, beat n plus 1 should be quite predictable based on beat n. Okay? So this is our high variability subject that you saw on the last slide. This is our low variability subject that you saw on the last slide. And although this person does show some pretty decent change across the course of the entire experiment, on a beat-to-beat basis, there's very little variability. For this person, on a beat-to-beat basis, there's quite a bit of variability. Okay? Just another way of conceptualizing the data, and there are some metrics that are based upon looking at kind of the ratio of this distance to this distance. Now, these are just many of the different metrics, but what I'll just show you is in terms of total heart rate variability, the two subjects differ a bit, but by less than one unit, one log unit. So this person has 9.2, this person has 8.3 log millisecond units. Okay? But in terms of RSA, that is that variability related to the respiratory cycle, they differ by considerably more. This person's 8.8 and this person's 5.3. So you can see there's quite a bit of difference there. There's one other very easy metric to quantify for parasympathetic control, and that's called PNN50. It's the portion of normal intervals that differ one to the next by more than 50 milliseconds. In other words, if this IBI is 800 and this one's 851, differs by 51 milliseconds, that would count. If this one's 800 and this one's 840, that differs by 40, it doesn't count. So you add up all of the intervals you have, what proportion of them differ by more than 50 milliseconds one to the next? You can see here, 57% of those intervals differ by more than 50 milliseconds one to the next. And that's a pretty high index of parasympathetic control. Now, a couple of different things are studied in this field. One of them is kind of tonic, and the other is phasic control that we'll talk about here in a moment. Porges, though, talks about this in terms of the dual control system of the parasympathetic nervous system on interbeat interval. So there are two vagal efferent branches that terminate on the SA node, according to Porges. One he calls the reptilian dumb vagus. That originates in the dorsal motor nucleus. And some heavy-duty activity here will cause you to faint. And it causes a massive reduction in heart rate. It causes conservation of oxygen. It's involved in the dive reflex. The dive reflex here is shown for a diving seal. The basal heart rate during normal activity is somewhere around 130 beats per minute. And the seal dives deep, and there's cold, pressure, and holding the breath, and those together and the activity of the dorsal motor nucleus cause the heart rate to plummet down to 20 beats per minute. So it's a way to conserve oxygen while the seal forages around under there and gets whatever it wants to eat, presumably, and then come back up and got a nice big heart rate. So there was an episode, a classic episode of ER about 10 years ago where all the power went out and everything was terrible and they had to leave the usual place. And this guy goes into tachycardia and he can't get his heart rate down. And so the young resident takes his face and sticks it in the cafeteria, he sticks it in a bucket of ice. And that cold sensor on the forehead, combined with the guy holding his breath because he's in a bucket of ice, causes heart rate to go right back down and normalize. Okay. Science does get into TB every once in a while. All right. Now, that's not really of interest psychologically. You know, okay, people faint. That might be interesting. But what we're really interested in are more dynamic and adaptive changes. And what Porges talks about here is that there's a phylogenetic newer smart vagus, and this originates from the nucleus ambiguus. And you can see the Latin namers here. They just really didn't know what to make of it, so they called it the nucleus ambiguus. Now, a point of contention here, people like Paul Grossman suggest that you can see, this isn't so phylogenetic new, you can even see this kind of thing in reptiles. And that's a point of contention, but there are two control centers. That's not a point of contention. Porges talks about this one being more adaptive in a moment-to-moment way to help modulate heart rate in response to things like emotional engagement, emotional expression, attention, communication. And it lets the organism adaptively respond to challenges without having to faint or fight or flee. Okay? And so when there's some kind of stressor, it will phasically withdraw its inhibitory influence, allowing you to mobilize a bit and then reinstate it quickly once that stressor has passed. And he sees it as a key to helping us learn how to modulate our own emotions, to self-soothe, and to function in a social environment. And he talks about, you know, one of the big challenges in a social environment is not to be petrified of somebody you've never met before, right? But you can modulate your own activity using a dynamic system like this. Now, as I mentioned, the polyvagal theory is not without its critics, if you want to read a fairly detailed critique of it, you can look at Grossman and Taylor, for example. Now, Forges talks about kind of three autonomic nervous system levels of adaptation, and you try to use the best, and if it fails, you go to the next, and if it fails, you go to the next. So the myelinated vagus, which comes from the nucleus ambiguous, it's the smart vagus, allows kind of adaptive online responsive control, and it might be involved in social communication, self-soothing, calming, helping us to regulate in an adaptive way along the way. Now, if that doesn't work, you know, somebody's looking a little dangerous, I'm not able to calm myself enough, then maybe what I could do is turn to the sympathetic adrenal system, and this is a fight-or-flight system, and mobilize me for action, active avoidance or potentially attack. And I guess it looks like that's really not going to work either, and I'm just petrified, then the unmyelinated vagus can take over, and there'll be immobilization, depth fainting, or passive avoidance. A strategy used maybe more by reptiles than humans, although humans are not immune to using this strategy either. You see people faint, for example. By the way, a funny but true story. I had broken my toe in a klutzy maneuver, and knowing how medical care works, so I was off to the emergency room because it was pointed sideways, and I knew I had to get some care for it. I couldn't get it back pointing myself. But knowing what emergency rooms are like, I took some reading along, and it was a bunch of Porges' articles. So there I am, reading about vagal control, and I'm reading all about vagal control. And a couple hours go by, it's 1 or 2 in the morning, and the whole place was full. They finally set me on some chairs, and we're going to reset the toe. And they asked me if I wanted Novocaine, and they tried a little bit of yanking and convinced me I wanted Novocaine. So they put some in, and then right away she was going to yank the toe. And I always thought these things took a while, and I asked her, you know, shouldn't we wait a little while for the Novocaine to take effect? No, no problem. And then there's this gap of about 15 seconds in my memory, and I have a real bad headache, and I'm on the floor. And I had fainted. And the first thing that the doctor says, you went vagal on me. I was reading my vagal control articles all up on this stuff, and this dumb vagal system just took over when, obviously, I didn't see it coming. I couldn't adapt responsively. I couldn't get out of the way, and the pain was intense, and I just immobilized quite quickly. So, not the preferred system. So then I wrote Steve Porges and told him about this, and he thought it was pretty funny. But he said I should have used my other system. So. Okay. Now, this can be measured as a tonic indicator, an individual difference that we would look at, say, measured at rest over the course of, you know, several minutes. We can also look at phasic changes during tasks. And so when you think about the tonic level, one way of thinking about this is the capacity to self-regulate and the capacity to adaptively respond with cardiovascular changes. And the phasic change indicates the actualization of that capacity. So, for example, with respect to attention and emotion, this has been studied fairly extensively. And some early work by Porges found that higher vagal tone, I put tone in quotes because it's a term that's been used in the literature again and again and again, and it's not a term that I like because it sounds like something static. But it's not static. It's a description of the dynamic nature of the system. So the term that I suggested in the special issue we use is cardiac vagal control. And it's catching on, at least with the people whose papers I'm editor for, that are using cardiac vagal control. But I think it more adequately captures what's going on here. It's a tendency or description of the usual degree of cardiac vagal control. But tone is used in literature, and so I use it here in the same way. But people who had higher RSA, higher vagal tone, higher cardiac vagal control, had faster reaction times to some task requiring sustained attention, which suggests they have a greater capacity to modulate, interrupt heart rate, and reinstate heart rate changes when necessary. And in a study with hyperactive kids treated with Ritalin, all their attentional skills improved, but they also showed appropriate task suppression, task-related suppression of heart rate that they didn't show prior to taking the medication in a sustained attention task. So their attention improved and the task-related suppression of heart rate variability was seen following that. Ted Bouchain, who's done quite a bit of work with behaviorally disturbed kids, looks at low baseline vagal tone related to emotional traits that are negative and high vagal withdrawal to negative emotional states, which I think is an interesting way to conceptualize it. So here's an example of some things that you can see. This was a task that Hal Mobius had as part of his dissertation research. We had a baseline period where people just sat quietly for 5 minutes. We had a paced mental subtraction task where people had to subtract 13 from some large number, and they had somebody watching them, and when they were wrong, he said wrong. So it's a stressful task. It's a socially stressful task. And then we had a recovery phase where we asked them to sit quietly and relax and gave them a few relaxation instructions. This graph shows two things. There's both individual differences and also task-related effects. So at baseline, people who are high and low socially anxious don't differ in terms of their RSA. Everybody shows some suppression and some recovery, but there's also greater suppression in low anxious people than high anxious people, which is a sign that they're more adaptive in responding to this challenge, this paced mental arithmetic task. Now, in terms of individual differences in cardiac vagal control, or trait vagal tone, as it's also been called, this is just a little bit of a sample of a lot of things that you can find. The early work here with infants was work done by Porges, and various sick infants have lower vagal tone, respiratory distress syndrome, hydrocephalic, and it's actually a predictor of outcome. So kids who have the lowest vagal tone have the highest mortality rates and the lowest, the poorest prognosis. In several studies conducted by Porges, he looked at infants, 5-month-old infants, 9-month-old infants, and he found repeatedly that those with higher cardiac vagal control, higher RSA, were more emotionally reactive, so they're more responsive to the environment, the environmental stimuli. This was shown both in terms of positive and negative stimuli. So, for example, 5-month-old infants with greater heart rate variability had more interest, more joy to positive stimuli, but more look-away behaviors towards a stranger. And 9-month-old infants with higher vagal tone were more reactive, also rated more difficult by their moms. But the higher vagal tone at that early age also predicted better social competence down the road and better adjustment down the road at 3 years old. So it seems this early reactivity may be a little more difficult for the people around, but ultimately helps them kind of develop a way of responding more adaptively. Now, in terms of other applications, so groups that might not be particularly flexible or adaptive would be those with anxiety disorders. And a study by Julian Thayer and his colleagues in 1996, Tom Borkovec and others, looked at vagal control in generalized anxiety disorder. So if you don't know about generalized anxiety disorder, these people are worriers. They worry a lot. They worry about multiple areas of their life, and they have a lot of physiological signs of anxiety that accompany that. They worry about things excessively and in ways that are not very productive. And this is yet another metric of RSA. It's called high-frequency power. We can talk about that in lab, perhaps. This is a terrible reproduction of the graph, but the people with lower power, lower vagal control, are the GAD people. And so these are the controls, and these smaller bars are the generalized anxiety disorder patients. And what we see is that under conditions of relaxation, the controls have much higher RSA than do the generalized anxiety disorder patients. That's true also under a condition where they're told to worry about things that might be bothering them. What you also see is the controls show some task-appropriate suppression, and there's a little bit of task suppression also in the GAD patients, but overall they just have lower cardiac vagal control. And Bruce Friedman and Julian Thayer looked at vagal control and panic disorder, and there wasn't a graph, so there's this rather complicated table. But let me just show here. This is high-frequency power. Again, it's a measure of RSA. And what you see is that control have much more than blood phobics that are intermediate, but mostly panic patients have very low vagal control. So again, these people may not have the capacity to respond adaptively when confronted with these emotional challenges. That would be the prediction based on polyvagal theory. Okay. In terms of depression, it's been examined as well. So altered vagal control may not be specific to anxiety. There's some evidence that depression may be characterized by lower cardiac vagal control. It's been seen in a number of different